started?
And then I replace it with Get Stereo.
Yep.
Right. Okay. Perfect. Good afternoon, Mr. Teicher. It's Brad Bondi. It's 137 on May 4th, 2010, here for the meeting with Moody's and Mr. David Teicher. For the record, we'll go around and just introduce who's in the room. I'm Brad Bondi. It's B-O-N-D-I.
Ryan Bubb, B-U-B-B.
Shaista Ahmed, S-H-A-I-S-T-A-A-H-M-E-B.
Karen Dubas, D-U-B-A-S.
Stephen Ross from Akin Gum.
David Teicher from Moody's.
Constance O'Connor from Akin Gum.
Megan Greer from Akin Gum.
Mr. Teicher, can you spell your last name for us?
Sure, it's T-E-I-C-H-E-R.
Great, thank you. And are you currently employed by Moody's?
I am.
And what do you do for Moody's?
My current role is the project manager for the implementation of the new European Union regulations on rating agencies.
How long have you been in that position?
I've been in this position for, I guess, since August of last year.
2009.
2009, correct.
Great. If you can, for our purposes, just give us a brief overview, first starting with your education, and then we'll work our way through employment up to present.
Okay, sure. I was a undergraduate at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut, where I majored in physics. I worked for 3 years at Bell Laboratories in Murray Hill, New Jersey, doing research in chemistry, physical chemistry and physics. I went to law school and business school at the University of Chicago. I worked at Brown and Wood initially after law school, doing securitization work. I also worked in-house at Montefiore Medical Center in New York, as well as in the New York office of McDermott Will. I then became general counsel of a company called LEMAC, which stands for Local Initiatives Managed Assets Corporation, which was a organization set up to do securitization work with multifamily housing loans. And from there, I went to Moody's. I started in the residential mortgage-backed securities group as an analyst.
What year was that?
That was in 1996. I was in that group through 2001, through fall of 2001, when I moved and became an analyst in the CDO group. I was an analyst there until, I don't remember when, it was sometime in 2005, I became head of the CDO surveillance team, which was still within the CDO group. And then I moved back to RMBS in March of 2006, where I was one of three managing directors of that group, and was in that position until September of 2008, when I became head of the compliance department at Moody's. And then I transferred to my current role.
You transferred to your current role in August 2009?
August 2009, yeah.
I should have gone over our background administrative stuff first, and I know we were chatting a little bit beforehand, so I got a little bit of ahead of ourselves. But we're with the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission in Washington. We're created by Congress as a bipartisan commission. We're the staff of the commission. We're tasked with investigating the causes of the financial crisis, both domestically and globally. The commission, by statute, is also tasked with looking at 22 specific areas, including credit ratings and the rating agencies. our investigation is confidential by nature, so we ask that you don't discuss outside of your lawyers what we talk about here today. You've consented to being recorded, correct?
Yes.
And because we are being recorded, just make sure, please, that your answers are verbal as opposed to nodding your head so that the transcript picks up on your answer.
And
I'm also obligated just to let you know, because we're agents of the government, 18 U.S.C. 1001 would apply, and Mr. Ross can explain that to you. In essence, it makes it a crime to knowingly or willfully provide false information or misleading information to a government employee during the course of their duties, and he can explain offline exactly what that means. But I have no reason to believe that you're not going to be truthful today, but I am required to put you on notice that applies.
Okay.
You're not under oath, though, today, but that statute does apply. So. Going back to your employment history at Moody's, you mentioned that from 96 to 2001 you were an analyst in the residential mortgage-backed securities area.
That's right.
To whom did you report?
Initially I reported to Linda Stesny and Catherine Needham, and then it was Linda Stevenson, and then it was... and Linda Stesny.
What happened to Molson?
I guess I don't know exactly or the details. I mean, you know, left Moody's and went to work for Nomura in their ABS research area.
Mr. Fire?
That's my understanding, but I don't know for a fact.
Have you ever talked to him about the reasons why he was fired from Moody's?
We have talked about it. I'm trying to remember it because it's been a while. I believe he did tell me he was let go, that he was asked to leave. Yeah, I think he told me that.
Did he tell you why?
I'm trying to remember. I don't remember that he told me specifically why. I recall that, I don't know, this is really going back. My vague recollection is, you know, there were disagreements about style, but I can't really remember. I mean, had something of an adversarial relationship with people in the market. I don't know. I mean, I think there was something related to that.
Did anyone within Moody's ever express to you the reason or reasons why he was fired?
Nobody who I think had knowledge of it. I don't remember. I remember a conversation with Brian Clarkson where he said something about his management skills or something, you know, like people management skills. But again, I mean, I'm just the memory is pretty dim.
Okay. You mentioned. Do you still keep in contact with her by any chance?
No.
Do you know where she is?
I do not.
And do you understand that she retired from Moody's? Is that your understanding?
Yeah, I mean, I remember that she left Moody's. I don't remember if it was retirement or, you know, what, but I remember, you know, that she did leave.
Now, if I have your chronology down, in 2001, you became an analyst in the CDO group?
Yes, that's right.
And were you a legal analyst or a quantitative analyst?
I was a legal analyst.
Okay. What's a legal analyst do?
In the CDO group, they divided, they staffed deals with two analysts. You know, one analyst to, the legal analyst would review the governing documentation for the CDO, principally the indenture. And it was a maybe a collateral management agreement or something. I can't remember exactly. The legal opinions, you know, just basically sort of review the legal side of it. And then the quantitative analyst would do the modeling of the transaction.
And if I have my notes down correct, you left that group in 05 to join the CDO surveillance group. Is that correct?
Well, it was sort of a separate group within the same group. So I sort of moved over. They had just recently formed a separate surveillance team.
When in 05 did you move over?
I remember. I think it was May, April, May of 05, something in that range.
Okay. And between 2001 and May of 2005, working as an analyst in the CDO group, to whom did you report?
I reported to 2001, 2005. Initially, it was Jerry Gluck, Isaac Efrat, and Gus Harris. And then at some point, Bill May was promoted, and he was one of the managers. And then Isaac left, so it was Jerry, Bill, and Gus. And then Jerry left, and I can't remember the exact order, but Yuri Yoshizawa and Gary Witt were promoted. And I think maybe at the same time that Yuri and Gary were promoted, Gus was promoted to group managing director, to whom they reported, I think. And then after that, when I switched over to the surveillance side, I reported to Gus Harris.
And as an analyst in the CDO group from 01 to 05, were you involved in rating any particular types of CDOs? In other words, did you have a specialty that it was certain types of CDOs, or did you rate all types of CDOs you personally were involved in?
I wouldn't say all types. It was mostly CLOs and ABS CDOs. I don't remember if I ever worked on any derivative products companies, or I don't think I worked on any market value CDOs. So I would say it seemed primarily those two types.
Any synthetic CDOs?
I certainly worked on some synthetic transactions. I think, you know, the main thrust of synthetic CDOs kind of came in after I left, but I think I did, yeah. I mean, I definitely worked on some synthetic transactions. I can't remember now if they were... Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did, yeah.
On the ABS CDOs, were these CDOs that were backed by RMBS, residential mortgage-backed securities?
Yes.
And so when you use the term ABS CDOs, you mean CDOs that were backed by RMBS or backed by RMBS and other asset-backed securities?
Well, both. The market in, I think, 2001 or before, the ABS CDO market tended to be a wider range of ABS. After that, it focused more on real estate assets. So my recollection is it could include a variety of RMBS and maybe some commercial mortgage-backed securities as well. I could be misremembering that. But I do remember that most of the securities for the ABS transactions I worked on were we're residential, we're mortgage related securities.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you mentioned earlier that when you joined the CDO surveillance group in May of 2005, you reported to Gus Harris. Is
mm-hmm.
that correct?
That's right.
Do you report to anyone else?
At that time, no, I don't think so.
Did you eventually report to anyone else when you were in the role of CDO surveillance?
No, I think during that time, I only reported to Gus.
What was your title when you were doing the CDO surveillance? Were you still an analyst, or did you have a different title?
I mean, my title was Senior Vice President, which was an analyst title that I've had since I had left the mortgage group.
Was the CDO surveillance group that you joined in May of 2005, was that a newly formed group, or was that an existing group that you then joined?
That was a relatively newly formed group. I think it had been formed just earlier that year, and John Polansky had initially been running that group when it was formed, and then he went to run the ABCP group. And I was asked to come into the group. So the group was still very new at the point in time when I took it over.
And what did the CDO surveillance group do? What was the purpose of it?
The purpose was to have a separate group that would monitor the ratings on existing CDOs.
And this was CDOs that Moody's had rated and had a contractual obligation to monitor the performance?
Well, when you say contractual obligation to monitor, I'm not sure what you mean. I mean, our practices are to monitor the ratings on securities, you know, the ratings we have outstanding on securities to see that they're up to date and they incorporate current information. So these were the securities that, you know, the CDO related securities we'd already rated. And this was a function, a separate function to keep track of the performance of the transactions of which those securities were a part to see if a rating change would be warranted.
Going back to your chronology, in March of 2006, you became the managing director in the RMBS group?
That's right.
And RMBS is residential mortgage-backed securities.
That's correct.
To whom did you report as the managing director of the RMBS group?
I reported to Michael Caniff.
Did you report to anyone else during this time period of March 2006 to September 2008?
No. Well, I believe, you know, Michael had transferred over to head of regulatory affairs and compliance, I believe, in January of 2008. And during that interim period, I think it was John Polansky who was in his role. So I think I reported to John during that period, I guess during 2008. I'm trying to remember now because I may have reported to Claire Robinson for a while during that period. It was, you know, it was a period where the market was very slow and, you know, the same levels of management didn't seem needed, and so there was some overlap, and I can't remember exactly. I have to sort of look back. But it was either Claire or John or, you know, so it was some combination of the two.
Who reported to you as the managing director?
Basically, the analysts in the RMBS group.
How many analysts were there?
Well, when I started in early 2006, there was something like 50 or 60 analysts, and then, you know, senior associates, you know, some admin staff in the group, and then the group grew some during, you know, that period of time. I can't remember if it was 45 or 50 or 60. I mean, it was somewhere in that sort of range, and it grew, I think, to something like 60 by the end of 2006, and then it shrank back And it was myself and Warren Kornfeld and Mark Darienz who were managing the group together. We were co-heading the group.
And how was there a division of labor between Mr. Kornfest and who was the other name? I'm sorry.
Mark Darienz.
Could you spell the name, please?
D, little I, R, I, E, N, Z. Darienz.
His first name's Mark?
Mark.
Okay. And Warren?
Kornfeld. K-O-R-N-F-E-L-D.
Was there a division of labor between the three of you as managing directors?
Not a real formal division. I will say that, like for instance, there were certain specific things, you know, mostly the unpleasant tasks that they allocated to me as the new kid on the block, such as dealing with fee issues with issuers. But there wasn't, you know, and there were certain specific projects like M3 that maybe Warren was more involved in. But, you know, I mean, we pretty much shared responsibility.
And did the composition of the three of you as managing directors ever change during your tenure in the RMBS group?
I think it was early in 07 that Mark transferred and became the head of the Term ABS group. That was the group that rated credit cards, autos, student loans. So then it was myself and Warren who were managing the group. And then, actually, we still, in terms of staffing, I'm just thinking now that I don't think the staff declined really until the end of 2007 or towards the end of 2007. I think the staff remained at around 60 or in that sort of range through most of 2007. Then it was he and I who were managing the group. And then at some point, I guess it was maybe 2008, he assumed additional responsibilities or other responsibilities someplace else, and I can't remember exactly what it was, but it might have been related to certain specific projects, and I was heading the group by myself at that point.
Who was the number one, or who was your largest client in the RMBS space?
Well, I guess First off, we don't view the people we work with as clients, since we don't represent the interests of any particular party. So we don't call people clients. I mean, if you're referring to sort of which issuers or which investment banks we've worked mostly with, I don't know that I could say. I mean, I can't remember there being one that dominated. I mean, there were certainly large issuers in the market, like Countrywide, like Wells Fargo. I don't remember Goldman Sachs being particularly active in the residential mortgage market, though they obviously were active. Bear Stearns, Lehman Brothers. I mean, I can't say which were the parties we had most interaction with. But certainly the issuers who were issuing RMBS more frequently would be the ones we'd be interacting with more.
Yeah, but would it make sense maybe at this point to have David sort of go through the presentation of the RMBS process? And then I think that'll
let me finish the chronology just at the start here and your employment chronology, and then if we could have you walk through the slides that you have, that'd be very helpful. I'm just trying to get down the chronology so that we don't ask you any stupid questions. And we know what areas you worked in when, so we get the questions right. If you don't
mind. The last group of questions seem to depart from the chronology. That's why I thought it might make sense.
Yeah, I hear you. Back to the chronology. September 2008, you said you became head of compliance. Is that right?
That's right.
Who did you replace?
I replaced.
And what happened to?
I don't know exactly. It wasn't something I was involved in, but my understanding is he was asked to leave.
What is your understanding of why he was asked to leave?
You know, again, I wasn't really involved in that. in that process or that decision.
What did you hear, though?
I guess I had heard that he wasn't doing a very good job, that he wasn't building the group, building the function. He wasn't doing a good job.
Mm-hmm. And who'd you hear that from?
I've heard that actually from a number of people. Told me that. I ran into somebody who used to work at Moody's, used to be head of our tax department, who told me that from his perspective.
Just so I have that down, who was the person who used to work in the tax department who gave you that perspective? Who hired you to be chief compliance officer?
I guess it was Michael Kana. I mean, he was the one who had spoken to me about it.
And to whom did you report as chief compliance officer?
Michael.
And what was your, did you have a prior background or experience in compliance when you became chief compliance officer in September 2008?
As I said, I'd been, I had a legal background. I had been general counsel at the company for 6 years before I came to Moody's. So that wasn't, that was related experience. Yeah.
When were you, was that a position you applied for? Was that a position you were approached about? How'd the evolution come about that you went from the managing director of the RMBS section to being chief compliance officer?
I was approached to take the position.
Approached by Mr. Kana?
Yes.
And when would you have been approached?
I think it was earlier that year, maybe April.
Was that during a time period when Mr. McCleskey was still chief compliance officer?
Yes.
And did you make any changes when you became chief compliance officer in September 2008?
There were a number of things that I would say, changes. There were certain staff members who were there that I got involved in different things. I, hired a number of people, over the course of that time. There were a number of initiatives to focus on. We were involved in revising, our code of professional conduct. There were SEC rules, both existing and new ones coming down the pike, that we needed to implement changes to be in compliance with those. So, there were a number of things along those lines that, I was very focused on.
And who replaced you as the managing director in the RMBS group when you left to join compliance?
I think it was Debash Chatterjee, who was a team leader at the time.
Could you spell his name?
It's, first name is... Debash, D-E-B-A-S-H, and second name is C-H-A-T-T-E-R-J-E-E, I believe.
And going back to the chronology, you were chief compliance officer until August of 2009, is that correct?
That's correct.
And then you joined your current position.
That's right.
Great. Okay. I understand you are going to walk us through the RMBS rating process. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, if that would be helpful to you.
That would be. Thank you. You want to? I'll tell you what. I'll turn the floor over to you if you can. I know you have some PowerPoints. If you could walk us through the process, that would be very helpful.
Sure. Sure. Let me know if I'm belaboring points that are obvious, or if you want me to answer any more detailed questions that aren't here. Mm-hmm. But this is basically a...
I think you can skip ahead past the origination process, and we can cut to the... We're most interested in when Moody's becomes involved.
Sure, sure.
But feel free to refer back. There are important aspects of the origination process to inform my understanding of Moody's role, of course, please. Discuss those. But we understand the basics of the mortgage market.
Sure.
So we'll start here. 13.
You want to start with 9? The decision to securitize?
Why don't you decide, Mr. Teicher, what you think would be the best way to explain that? Or 9 or 13 seem like reasonable launching points to us.
I start at 9, just a little bit more background. I just want to, I guess one of the points I'd like to make is just the context in which, we operate and what our specific role is and, where we come into the process. So, I think the presentation is good in the sense that it captures that part of where we fit in. So lenders originated loans, and they can choose to, keep the loans on their books, sell them as whole loans, or securitize them. And that's a decision they make based on, the market and the economics of each of those options to them, and what their overall mortgage origination plans are. And just to emphasize that, a certain percentage of mortgages are never securitized. And the securitizations that we see are the ones that are not done by the GSEs. So we're in the segment of the market that's the private label market.
Do you rate agency MBS or GSE MBS at all? Well, or is it a different group within Moody's who does the rating?
Well, we rate the GSEs themselves. We rate Freddie and Fannie separately, and the securities they offer, I understand, are fully backed by them. So those securities would be like corporate bonds. They would bear the rating of the issuer.
So, but you do actually issue a rating?
No. I don't believe so. I don't believe we assign a separate specific rating to the securities that Freddie or Fannie issue. I think it's just implied by the rating we have on Freddie and Fannie as corporate entities. I'm not 100% sure about that, but that's my understanding.
Yeah, I've wondered.
Certainly not in the RMBS group do we do that.
Great.
Let's see. And then there's an entity that's sponsoring the transaction that's basically the person who's got the most responsibility for it or to initiate it. And they would hire the investment banker who would advise that sponsor on which mortgages to put into securitization, how to structure the deal. They would perform due diligence on the loans. And on 11, there are just the three elements that are usually looked at in the due diligence process, which includes meeting underwriting standards, compliance with law, and a review of the valuations, the appraisals.
If I can interrupt at that point, there's a reference here on page 11 to due diligence firms like Clayton and Bohan Partners. Mm-hmm. What information would Moody's receive from these due diligence firms, these third-party due diligence firms?
It varied a lot, and it wasn't We didn't require that at that time, you know, back in, you know, pre-2007, we didn't require due diligence information. We were relying on representations and warranties that the issuers were making in the legal documents. We were relying on the disclosure that they were making in the prospectuses. And just, you know, we were relying on the fact that they were, by and large, you know, reputable, you know, well-capitalized institutions, that the information was accurate. Now, we thought at the time that to the extent that they had done due diligence and they could share the due diligence with us, we would view that as an additional positive factor. So basically we got due diligence information when they wanted to share it to show us that they had done extra work, and, you know, more than we were assuming. So sometimes it was just a one-page summary of the results of the due diligence. Sometimes it was a more detailed report, but there was no kind of standard, you know, deal to deal. It was much more ad hoc.
And you suggested, and forgive me, I'm not trying to put words in your mouth at any point, if I ever make any suggestions or statements that are incorrect, always just interrupt me. But you had suggested or hinted, it seemed, that there was some change in this process in 2007 where you began requesting, as a matter of course, due diligence information. Is that correct?
That's right. At some point in 2007, I can't remember exactly when, probably middle of the year, we started actually asking for due diligence reports to the extent that they had them. I mean, not all issuers had done due diligence. But, you know, where they had them, we were requesting them.
Why the change in the middle of 2007? Where you began asking for the due diligence report?
Well, I mean, you know, after we saw the, you know, just the rapid and unprecedented deterioration of performance that occurred, you know, in 2007, in the performance of mortgage loans and the allegations that were floating around in the press and the market about fraud and inaccuracy in information, and the fact that entities were starting to go out of business because, you know, it turned out the reps and warranties they were making were inaccurate, and they were being compelled to repurchase loans that they had sold. We felt that we could no longer just rely on the representation of the warranties and the disclosure being made in the prospectuses, that we needed to get additional information. You know, our thinking about it was changing as we saw the market conditions changing.
So this is after New Century failed, after some of the other mortgage originators like HSBC got into trouble.
Right.
You started asking for the due diligence reports. And you mentioned fraud. In 2004, the FBI issued a warning in some testimony. Chris Swecker testified before Congress about the growing presence of fraud in the origination market. Did you do anything in response to those warnings by the FBI in 2004 about the growing presence of fraud in mortgage origination?
I can say we certainly published a lot about the changes in the market starting in 2003, about how underwriting standards were becoming more lax and more aggressive. In addition to commenting on it, we also changed our methodology to make our methodology, and for lack of a better word, more conservative, to sort of take into account that the loans were becoming riskier, even though at that point in time, the performance of subprime loans was stellar. We felt that, you know, looking ahead, there was a deterioration, and we started to take that into account in our rating process.
I may be jumping ahead of ourselves, and forgive me. I'm sure you'll get to that. But when did you change your methodologies in response to these concerns?
I mean, it was more of an ongoing process. It wasn't like, you know, we changed it at this point in time. It was more incremental changes. So we increased our loss expectations. We were asking for additional amounts of credit protection for given rating levels. We were asking for additional pieces of information. I'm sure that we can provide you with the reports and the methodology changes that we published, so you could sort of see, you know, what things were being done. But it was much more of an incremental process, and that's not unusual. I mean, we don't see our methodologies as being set in stone. It's an evolving process. We're always trying to make it better, more robust, capture more things as we see things, to incorporate those things into it.
And just to make sure we're not talking past each other, I don't think David is saying that it was in reaction to either the specific FBI report or the specific congressional testimony that you referenced that these changes were being made or taking place.
One other question about the due diligence firms and the process, just so I can understand how this worked. If these firms were doing due diligence on the mortgage pools, securitizations that you were rating, why not just ask for that information as a matter of course prior to the middle of 2007? I mean, it's additional data, right?
The feeling was, you know, as I mentioned, that it wasn't necessary to the process, that we believed in the accuracy of the information we were getting based on the things we were relying on, you know, reputation, reps and warranties, and public disclosure and 33 Act documents to which, you know, liability attaches.
In hindsight, would the information from the due diligence firms like Clayton and Bohan have been useful to you in hindsight to have had that information as you were rating these deals?
I mean, it's hard to say without having them. I mean, I can say that when we did start getting the due diligence information, it was viewed by us as being a positive thing. So if it made a difference at all, it made us more comfortable with the information, and it meant our loss expectations were lower.
In 2007, you said there was a change in policy, and you began requesting due diligence information.
Yeah.
If a sponsor or investment bank was unable to provide it, would you still rate the deal?
I mean, if they had it, if they had done it, and they refused to provide it, I can't remember, but I think we were requiring it if they had it and they wouldn't give it to us. But I could be misremembering that. I mean, there weren't a lot of transactions happening at that point, and, you know, maybe some providers had reasons for not providing it. I can't say absolutely.
In the case in which the sponsor had not done any due diligence, would you proceed to rate the deal?
If we thought we could otherwise rate it. I mean, for instance, I think some of the bigger issuers like Wells Fargo, you know, had their own broker-dealer. And so they didn't do separate due diligence. They had a quality control process internally where they, you know, reviewed loans as a matter of course as part of their origination process. And we would review that process. We would review their quality control practices to feel comfortable with that or understand what they were doing. But we wouldn't require them to do due diligence if they weren't already doing it.
And did you ever change your policy after that initial change in 2007 to actually require a third-party due diligence firm in order to rate a deal?
We did make a revision again, and there's a publication on this in December of 2008 called Third-Party Reviews. And I can't remember exactly whether we republished that later last year. I can't remember if there's an absolute requirement for a third-party review, but it definitely strengthened our policy around due diligence, which we call third-party reviews, just to take into account. It might be an accounting firm, or it might be some other party doing something technically that's not due diligence. But it would be in there, whatever our current policy is.
And what brought about that subsequent change in policy, that strengthening and stronger requirement of what you call third-party review?
Basically, it was just further thinking about it and further thinking about what we thought was needed in light of market conditions and what we had seen in terms of, you know, what we felt we needed in order to create transactions.
Was there concern that sponsors that had not engaged a third-party review firm were producing lower-quality mortgages than firms that did engage a third-party review? What was it specifically in the market that led to this change?
It was mostly just, you know, questions about the accuracy of information we were getting, the accuracy of appraisals, you know, the accuracy of, you know, all the pieces of information that we were getting and relying on.
And what specifically made the management at Moody's doubt the accuracy of the information?
I don't know if there was one specific thing other than our general sense from the marketplace, from the fact that so many loans were being put back to their lenders for breaches of reps and warranties. I don't think it was one specific thing. I think it was just a general sense from those events in the market that there was a question about the accuracy of information. I should also mention that in addition to the specific criteria around third-party reviews that we put out for the RMBS deals in particular, you know, we also have advocated for a stronger disclosure regime for structured finance more generally, to kind of bring it more into line with the kinds of disclosure that's now mandated for corporations and the financials of corporations, to have a more kind of rigorous requirement on the part of issuers to provide public information and to have that information certified or verified by some third party, you know, an auditor or a due diligence firm or something. We've advocated for that because we think that would be very beneficial to the market. It would make everybody in the market able to rely more on the information they're getting.
Do issuers typically provide loan-level information about the collateral in an RMBS to the public, to investors?
I mean, they've provided it to us as part of our rating process. They've provided some summary information and prospectuses. And I believe that some issuers at some point started to provide loan-by-loan information to investors. You know, they'd have a website where you could go and get loan-by-loan information on different deals. But I don't remember the specific details. I mean, it wasn't directly of interest to us because we were getting the information separately, so it wasn't something we particularly focused on. But I remember hearing that and thinking that was a positive development, that there'd just be more transparency in the market and more information available.
I don't want to get too bogged down on these questions and let you get back to the presentation, but I do have one last point on the due diligence firms. The decision to begin asking for the due diligence reports from Clayton and Bohan in the middle of 2007, who was involved in that decision?
I guess that would have been, you know, myself, Warren, and Michael Kana.
And was there a publication that Moody's released around this time announcing that decision?
I don't believe so. I think it was more of a practice we had decided, internally to adopt. I don't think it was a very formal kind of a decision. There was a lot going on in the market at the time, and we were engaged in a lot of different things at the time. I think that was just one of many things that, you know, we started to do as a matter of practice.
Was the decision memorialized in any way, an internal memo or an email to employees or?
I'm not. I don't recall anything like that.
Okay. You want to continue with the presentation?
Okay. So, you know, the banker will structure the transaction with an understanding of what investors are looking for and what the economics of different structures are and what the needs of the sponsor are with respect to the securitization. The bank generally also will hire the law firm to prepare the documentation for the transaction. And this is where we come in, and I've got just some notes I just made to myself about this. You know, generally the first contact we would have is when they would put the information, the loan-by-loan information, into a spreadsheet, an Excel spreadsheet that we would call the loan-by-loan tape. I think that harks back to a time when they really were tapes. And basically it would be, I don't know, it's the number of fields we have asked for has varied over time, but I think, you know, in 2006 it was probably something like 50 fields, something like that, 30 to 50.
It was a loan-level data set?
Yeah, it was a loan-level data set.
Was it always a loan-level data set? When did you start requiring a loan-level data set versus, let's say, pool-level statistics, weighted averages of the collateral characteristics?
It was the case when I started in 96 that we got loan-level information. I don't want to say never.
Sure.
There may have been, you know, one-off cases here and there, but as a general matter, we got loan-level information.
In terms of the spreadsheet that was provided to you by, first of all, I guess, who provided the spreadsheet to you?
It would be someone at the investment bank, usually one of their, you know, junior analysts would, I think, they had a colloquial name, I can't remember what it is, you know, who would gather the information and put it in a spreadsheet. So, you know, each row would be a different loan, and then each column would be a different characteristic. So, you know, one loan would be the loan-to-value ratio, the appraised value, the zip code of the property, you know, the borrower DTI, the debt-to-income ratio, you know, whether it was an adjustable-rate loan or a fixed-rate loan, what the interest rate was, you know, what the periodic caps were if it was a adjustable-rate loan, you know, what the occupancy status was, you know, just, you know, what the FICO score of the borrower was. I mean, just kind of just loan by loan. We didn't get the borrower name or any identifying information about the borrower or the specific street address. So they were sort of anonymous, but each loan had, you know, a generic number or something identifying it as a separate loan.
Would you get zip code?
We would get zip code, yeah.
And would you know from that spreadsheet whether the loan was a low doc or no doc loan?
Yes, the level of documentation would be provided. We actually had, I don't know if this was always true, but at some point we had 9 different codes for documentation type. Mm-hmm. So it went everywhere from, you know, full, I mean, down to, you know, nothing. And we would use that coding.
And can you speak for a little bit about the challenges in terms of rating a low doc or no doc pool of mortgages?
Well, you know, low doc or no doc loans had been in the market for many, many years. It wasn't, you know, an invention of recent times. Typically, it was in, you know, the Alt-A market that, you know, borrowers who were considered prime borrowers but who didn't want to provide all the documentation needed for a regular prime loan, you know, would provide something less. And so we had historical information about, you know, reduced documentation loans in other markets in other times. And we made inferences about how much riskier. I mean, it's clear that a loan with less documentation is riskier than a loan with more documentation, all other things being equal. But You know, and some of that was, you know, looking at historical differences in other markets, and some of it was just making inferences about how much riskier. And it also depended on what percentage of the loans were no doc or low doc. I mean, if 1% of the loans was low doc, you figure the impact is going to be, you know, not that great. If, you know, 60% of it is no doc, that's a much bigger issue.
And how does zip code factor in, if that's one of the fields, how does that factor in terms of the rate?
Basically, it factors in a couple of different ways. I mean, one is for looking at geographic distribution. You know, our belief was that a geographically diverse pool had less volatility than a geographically concentrated pool. We've certainly seen downturns in the housing market, New York, Texas, California, at different times, but we had never seen a national downturn. So the thought was, if you had a nationally diverse pool, you know, parts of it may suffer if the economic environment in that particular region suffered, but the whole pool wouldn't. And that was one thing, and this sort of goes back to, you know, when we're rating a pool, we're thinking about what's the performance going to be over its life, so across economic cycles. So, you know, what's going to happen with this pool, you know, if this region suffers a recession or that region suffers a downturn or whatever, and then comes out of it another region. And that was our basic perspective. So that was sort of one reason why we were getting the zip codes. And in addition to sort of state concentration, we would also look at some zip code concentrations to see if there was just a big concentration in one town. We also would look at the price of the home relative to the average price in a market, because we thought that homes that were expensive for their market were more susceptible to downturn, more susceptible to default than loans that were average for the market. And you can't tell that just from the amount of the loan. I mean, $1 million house is an extraordinary house. You know, some places in Greenwich, Connecticut, it's below average. So we would use that as a way of benchmarking that. We would also sometimes look at, like, MSA concentrations, which the zip code would tie into.
In your tenure as managing director in the RMBS area from 06 to 08, did there ever come a time where you just said, we got to watch that particular zip code, or you were getting reports of massive defaults or delinquencies from a particular zip code?
I don't recall that. I mean, the primary model we used, which is the Moody's Mortgage Metrics model, did have embedded in it state level, you know, certain economic data at the state level, particularly housing prices, unemployment rates, and interest rates. And we did have concerns about certain high levels of California concentration as a general matter, but no, we never actually tracked, you know, performance by zip code or region. I think that, again, you know, the thinking was, you know, there may be regional downturns, but because of the diversification of the pool, you know, it was intended to survive those, or, you know, take that into account. And so we were never trying to predict where, you know, the next recession was going to happen. We were trying to have ratings that would be appropriate regardless of which region went down.
Last question that I have on the spreadsheet point, was there any way that that the banks could game the process through the spreadsheet information or what they put on the spreadsheet? Did you come across any ways where they were, investment banks were trying to game the rating process through the information that was being disclosed on the spreadsheet, or how it was being, the pool was being arranged?
I mean, I'm not aware of a case where we sort of saw something happening on a spreadsheet. We thought, oh, they're definitely trying to game this. Or I mean, I don't remember that happening. I mean, there were times when, you know, we'd get the spreadsheet and, you know, like all the LTVs would be zero or something. And, you know, it was clearly just a, you know, a data error. They just coded it wrong or something of that sort. But I don't remember thinking that or hearing that they were sort of gaming us. I mean, the big concern was just the accuracy of the information. I mean, that, you know, the information that we were relying on was not accurate. If the LTVs and the appraisals and everything else were not accurate, then obviously that would have a big impact on our rating process. But other than that, I can't think of anything that they would be doing to game it. I mean, we were looking at, as I said, not just averages, but distributions. So, you know, I know there was some talk about, you know, barbelling. I mean, we would see any barbelling that was happening, and we would have taken that into account. So,
right. And some of the recent public discourse on barbelling has apparently been premised on the notion from Senator Kaufman that only average, pool average FICO scores were provided, which I don't believe is what David is saying, at least in the case of Moody's. I can't speak for other rating agencies.
Were the underwriters or issuers able to essentially do Moody's quantitative analysis on their own prior to submitting a pool of mortgages to be rated?
I mean, it depends on the time period you're talking about. We made Moody's Mortgage Metrics available to people on the outside. You know, we first started using it for Prime in, I think, 03 or 04. I wasn't in the group at the time, but I think it was somewhere around then. And we started using it for Subprime in late 06. And we made those available. I think the thing to remember, though, is that, you know, the rating was not a product of the model. The model didn't come out with a rating. The model would produce a loss coverage number for AAA, and it would come up with a projected and expected loss number for the pool. But in committee, we would always be making adjustments to those outputs based on aspects that weren't captured in the model or other qualitative adjustments. So nobody could ever know by having the model where the ratings were going to come out. I mean, pools did, you know, tend to become fairly standard, and I think if you had been a banker working with Moody's on a variety of deals, you could probably, you know, figure out pretty close where we would come out, but no one could just, like, have the model and then just know.
So there was a document you all published in 2003 when you adopted the Moody's mortgage metrics model said that essentially for prime loans, for jumbo loans, also for Alt-A loans, I believe, Moody's henceforth would rely principally, not exclusively, but principally on the automated quantitative model. And this was described by Moody's in your publication as a departure from past practice in which the quantitative model was given less weight in the process. Can you describe that change?
I mean, I wasn't in the group at the time, so I know that before M3 we used a factor-based model that basically just collected the loan-by-loan information and applied different factors to different characteristics. It was pretty simplistic. And I think the idea was that the M3 model would get a lot closer, that it was more robust, that it would look at risk layering. But I don't remember us ever relying exclusively on the M3 model. I mean, I wasn't aware that we did that, though it might have been sort of closer to that than our prior model, because we basically didn't really use the numbers.
Let me just read you the statement, just to
be clear about what it is I'm referring to.
Okay.
So this is the document I have in front of me is entitled Moody's Mortgage Metrics and Model Analysis of Residential Mortgage Pools, dated April 1st, 2003. And then on the second page it states, specifically, Moody's has refined its RMBS model for that set of large, geographically diverse jumbo A and Alt A pools from established originators and rated servicers to the point of delegating the bulk of the determination of these credit support levels to the model. So can you describe for us, when you came back to the RMBS group, to what extent did the model determine the ratings versus qualitative adjustments or other adjustments made by the ratings committee outside of the models? And to the extent you can, if you can quantify that, for example, if you can say things like, you know, most RMBS were rated in exactly the way the model outputs suggested, or most were not rated in the way the model output suggested.
I mean, it was, you know, my experience in coming back to the group that we never just took the model output at face value. I mean, if it's a standard jumbo pool from a known originator, we'd probably be closer to the model output. But again, you know, the model output are these two numbers. They're not the ratings. And maybe I could sort of walk through a little bit about what those numbers mean to us and how we use them to come up with the ratings. So, as I mentioned, you know, the model would produce what we would call the expected loss for the pool, which is just expected loss in a statistical sense. In a more general sense, I like to say it's kind of our, you know, projected best case, maybe not best case, but base case sort of assumption about how the loan pool would perform.
And by model, you refer specifically to the mortgage.
Yeah, the Moody's mortgage metric.
Moody's mortgage metric, sometimes known as M3. That's the same thing.
Right. We've referred to it colloquially internally as M3. I think they're
not M cubed.
We want to make sure we don't say 3M, though. that would be the model I'm referring to. So, for instance, say for an average subprime pool, we might have thought, okay, you know, cumulatively over the life of the pool, there'll be 5 or 6% losses. There'll be a number, say 5.5. And that would represent, you know, a combination, you know, over time of all the loans that defaulted and all the losses that were suffered on those loans that defaulted after recovery.
Subprime, but the model was only, if I understand what you said.
Yeah, that's right. Okay,
it was only used after, was it late 2006 that M3 was applied to subprime?
Right, that's right. That's right. I mean, we used it internally as one of the tools as part of the rating process for subprime before 2006. But it wasn't really calibrated, so we used it in a different way. Basically, the model would produce not just these numbers, but it would produce stratifications of the portfolio for us. So it would print out like a summary of the pool, where it would have, you know, the weighted average numbers, like weighted average FICO, weighted average LTV, but also it would show the bands of LTV and the bands of FICO.
What do you mean, the bands of LTV?
Well, like it would have, like, LTVs from 0 to 100 and would show what percentage of the pool was in each, like, 5% or 10% increment.
So a histogram.
A histogram, correct. And it would do that for FICO scores, for DTIs, and a whole bunch of other characteristics. And we got used to looking at the pool information in that form that would be produced by M3. It was also helpful for us to just see as a comparison, because before we applied M3, we were basically using what I call as a benchmarking approach, where we had been rating RMBS securities since, you know, the early 80s. Okay, we had a lot of prior experience rating the securities, seeing how pools had performed. And by looking at, you know, a current pool relative to prior pools that we had already rated, and then looking at how the current pool was riskier or less risky on average than the prior pools, and then looking at the levels of the prior pools, we could basically derive kind of our
when you say levels, you refer to levels of defaults?
No, sorry. Meaning our rating levels.
Oh, kind of.
Meaning the amount of loss coverage needed for a given rating level.
And well, why don't we? I don't yet understand the benchmarking approach, and would love for you to educate us on it. The approach used prior to M3. Why don't we first go through the M3 to make sure we understand the state of the art, and then we'll go back historically and do the the older stuff. We definitely want to follow up.
And when exactly was M3 first utilized?
I believe it was around the time of that publication.
April 1st, 2003.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, again, I wasn't in the group at the time, and I wasn't seeing it firsthand, but that's my best understanding.
Okay.
So the outputs are just to get us back on the earlier conversation thread. The model produces an expected loss for the pool, as well as an expected loss for the AAA tranche. Is that what you said? Forgive me, I'm misremembering.
It's not an expected loss for the AAA, but basically a loss coverage or a loss protection requirement for AAA.
I see.
That is to say, we expect, say it's a prime pool, and we expect half a basis point of losses cumulatively over its life. For AAA, we'd say, okay, we want 4%. You know, we think it needs 4% loss protection in order to get to a AAA rating.
So the bank did not propose at this point, in that spreadsheet they sent over, they don't propose any structure on the liability side?
No, they don't. The tape is just the loan characteristics. That proposal comes later.
Yeah, but would it help to continue the chronological?
Sure.
Yeah.
But you're sorry, but I just to make sure we follow up on this thread of the conversation. So you were going to, when I asked about how often the model dictated the ultimate rating of an RMBS, you were going to explain to us exactly how these two numbers are used. And we can do that chronologically, but let's be sure that you educate us on how that works. I don't understand it yet.
Yeah. Why don't we'll go through it chronologically, because I think there's a natural place.
Okay.
Okay, so we can go to the rating agency involvement. So I already talked about getting the loan-by-loan information. You know, we review that information, you know, ask questions about it to the extent there were any issues with it. And, you know, a junior person in the team would run that through the M3 model and give that output to the lead analyst in the group responsible for that transaction. So the lead analyst would go and get what we call these stratifications or these histograms for prior pools to use for comparison purposes, as well as looking at the model output, as well as going back to the banker and asking questions about the pool or, you know, what they're proposing to do, or, you know, if there are any questions about the origination or the underwriting standards or anything else. They would be engaged in gathering that information. And after having those conversations and pulling up that additional information, they might talk to other analysts in the group for guidance on different things. If they saw something unusual in the pool, they'd want to investigate that. We might have a separate committee just to talk, like your question about no-doc loans. You know, there might have been a time when, you know, this pool had more no-doc loans than another pool. You know, how are we going to handle that? And after gathering this information, they would prepare a committee memo with their recommendations, and the recommendations would be for these two numbers, the expected loss number and the loss coverage number for AAA. And that's what the analysts would go to committee with.
And it was not necessarily what the M3 produced.
As right. It was not necessarily what M3 produced. I mean, they would see the M3 output, and then they would adjust it. They would adjust it because of, you know, who they thought the servicer was, or different originators would have different factors that would be adjusted based on what their historical track record are, or just what we thought of them qualitatively, whether we thought they were better originators or worse from a credit perspective.
Would that lender evaluation incorporate concern about the veracity of the loan-level information produced by the originator?
It would certainly incorporate historical performance that you'd think would capture that implicitly. But again, I mean, we relied on, you know, the information being accurate.
And if you had more deals with a particular lender, would the qualitative assessment of that lender tend to be better?
Depends on the experience. There were certainly some very active issuers that we thought were worse than other issuers that were less active. Mm-hmm. It would really just, you know, depend on what they were producing and what we thought of their practices.
What was Countrywide's reputation during this period in terms of quality of origination, credit quality?
I don't remember off the top of my head. I can certainly, you know, we can certainly look that up or, you know, find out. But I actually don't. I don't recall.
In 2005 or 2006, were you privy to or aware of a conversation with Countrywide concerning concerns over its ratings on RMBS?
No. Was this a conversation between Moody's and Countrywide, or a conversation?
Correct.
No, I don't believe I was involved in that.
Do you recall at any time Countrywide complaining that its rating should be higher than the ratings for RMBS that it was receiving?
I don't remember a specific conversation, but every issuer would complain that their ratings were too low.
Did you ever receive any threats, direct or implicit, from any issuer that if ratings were not improved higher, that they would no longer send business to Moody's?
Oh, yeah, sure.
And can you tell us what issuers made those sorts of threats?
I don't remember specific issuers or specific instances, but I just, you know, certainly remember, you know, particularly investment bankers saying, you know, you're not going to be rating this deal. You know, S&P is much lower than you. I mean, things of that sort.
Lower in terms of credit enhancement.
I'm sorry, lower in terms of credit enhancement. Exactly.
And how, as a managing director, did you ensure that junior-level folks on your team, the 50 or 60 analysts that you described and the other associates, how did you ensure that they wouldn't be swayed by those threats, direct or implicit, by investment banks or issuers?
I mean, there were a number of ways. I mean, in terms of direct communications, you know, any banker or issuer that was getting very aggressive with a more junior person, that junior person would raise those concerns, and we would either I would get on the phone, or another managing director, or one of the senior, we had a number of senior, you know, very senior people on the team who would get on the phone with them if they felt, you know, the pressure was too much, or they were getting, you know, the bank was being too aggressive with them. I mean, the decision about the rating was a committee process. I mean, the analysts had no say over it. I mean, they brought their recommendations to committee, but at the end of the day, it was the committee who decided, and they can't go back and change it. I mean, it's what the committee said. you know, they're basically stuck. You know, all they can do is sort of come back and say, oh, well, they've made these arguments that it should be lower. But we wouldn't change ratings just because they wanted it, or, you know, the enhancement levels we would provide, just because they wanted it. I mean, people always wanted it. Issuers always wanted, you know, better, you know, favorable treatment. I mean, the other thing was that, you know, analysts weren't compensated to any significant degree based on whether a deal was rated or not. And we didn't, you know, the evaluation didn't take into consideration how many deals they rated. I mean, it might take into consideration how many deals they worked on in terms of productivity, but not how many deals actually were rated.
Was any compensation of the analyst in the RMBS group based in at all on revenue?
To a small extent, yes. And this has gone through some changes in recent times. In the past, you know, analysts were paid, you know, a base salary, you know, plus a bonus. And the bonus was, you know, some fraction of the base. It wasn't like investment banks where the bonus could be, you know, multiples of the base. I mean, it was basically, you know, 20%, 30% of the base, something like that. And some part of how big the bonus was depended on, you know, their individual performance, the performance of the group, you know, the financial performance of the group, and the performance of the company. So there was sort of a small component there that was tied to the revenue of the group. But it was very small, and it was. I mean, really, if an analyst wasn't maintaining standards, the fact that they got evaluated more harshly because of that would have a much bigger effect on their overall compensation than whether they got this deal or, you know, whether that deal was rated or not. I mean, since this time, nobody now is compensated based on the revenues of their individual group. There's still a tie-in to some extent with the revenues of the company overall, but there's no longer, the individual rating team revenues no longer factor into compensation in any respect whatsoever.
When did that change? When was that? When were rating teams' compensation delinked from the revenue of their group?
I believe that was in 07. I can't remember exactly. But that was true of everybody in the group, including managers.
Ask you a question that one of your colleagues was asked at the hearing a couple weeks ago, and that is, did you ever pull anyone off of an issuer or a bank because of a complaint that you had received about one of your employees?
And I'll interject in somewhat a similar fashion, because I want there to be clarity between, your question was, did anybody get pulled off of a bank?
A bank or an issuer.
Right. Well, and I'm going to ask you to divide that into, was anybody pulled off of a specific rating transaction that was underway, or not assigned to another for the same issuer?
My question is, with respect to a bank, Acme Bank or Acme issuer, you know, called you up, said, John Smith in your group, I don't like John Smith in your group. Did you ever pull John Smith off of doing a rating for Acme Bank or Acme issuer?
Yeah, and
what's wrong with the question?
Because there's a difference between when you say pull them off. Is it pull them off a transaction that is currently underway, or not assign them?
Okay, fair enough.
Yeah, that's where there was some confusion.
Fair enough. Let's make sure this is clear then. Okay, did you ever not assign a particular analyst to a bank or an issuer after receiving complaints from a bank or an issuer?
I don't remember everything.
Okay. And let's take the other part of that question.
Well, at least I never did it because of the complaints.
Okay.
I mean, I don't remember it happening, frankly, at all, but even if it happened, I don't remember it happening because I'd gotten a complaint. In fact, I don't even remember getting complaints about the analyst.
Okay.
And just so we're clear, I know there were associates in you other terms. Would the same answer apply for anyone in your group, associate, analyst, legal analyst, quantitative analyst, you name it? Did you ever pull anyone off of future deals or not assign a person to a future deal because of a complaint that you may have received?
No, I don't remember that ever happening.
Okay. Well, sorry, did you have anything else to add on that? I didn't want to cut you off.
Well, I'm just thinking, you know, about the way we allocated analysts to issuers and to deals. Mm-hmm. I mean, we took into consideration, you know, the seniority of the analyst, the expertise of the analyst, you know, how good they were at explaining our rationale to people. You know, if it's a very complicated deal, you don't want someone who isn't as good as explaining, you know, where we're coming out than somebody, you know, who's better. I think, you know, I'll answer the same way Yuri answered in the hearing, which is we never did it for the benefit of the banker. I mean, we might have allocated analysts to different issuers for our own purposes because we thought that would best serve, you know, the rating process. But it wasn't, you know, to benefit them. Or
what do you mean by best serve the rating process?
Meaning that, you know, if an analyst has... you know, it's a very complicated transaction, for instance. You don't want to assign, like, a junior analyst who's right out of business school necessarily to work on that. You want to have a more senior analyst, maybe somebody who has, you know, more sophisticated quantitative skills or, depending on the, you know, transaction, legal skills. I mean, just to be able to handle the issues and really get their head around the complexity and do a good job of analyzing it.
And ask sort of the converse of the earlier question. Did you ever assign any particular employee to a deal out of the request of an issuer or a bank?
No, I don't remember that ever happening either.
Okay. And in the interest of being complete, to take the other side of Mr. Ross's point, did you ever pull anyone off of a current deal, an ongoing deal, as a result of a complaint by an issuer or a bank?
Nope, not that I can recall. We may have put additional analysts on. I mean, there may have been times where a deal, it sort of became apparent that the analyst was foundering a little bit because of complexity or other issues, and we felt like they needed more support, so we put a more senior person on an addition or something. But I'm not even sure. I mean, that's just a vague sense that I have or something that we might have done.
What was the can-do attitude? Have you ever heard the phrase can-do attitude around Moody's?
No. Actually.
Nobody used the phrase that Moody's employees should have a can-do attitude when it comes to ratings?
No, I don't remember that phrase being used. It doesn't sound like something that would be used at Moody's. It sounds too, I don't know.
But Brad's question was whether you'd ever.
I don't recall ever hearing it now.
Did was there any RMBS deal that was not rated by Moody's during your tenure, where someone came to you and you just said, can't rate this deal, for whatever reason?
Sure. I mean, there were deals where, as I said, you know, our credit view was more, you know, negative, conservative, however you want to put it, than other rating agencies, and it was rated by other rating agencies and not us. I mean, I think that's the most common. I mean, I'm thinking, you know, in the RMBS group, there was a series of transactions called net interest margin transactions, which basically took the residual class from subprime securitizations and re-securitized them.
Like an RMBS squared, in essence?
Sort of, except that the residual class was never rated. to begin with. It was, you know, the thing at the bottom that just basically got the residual cash flow, so there was no promise on it. But people would put them into securitizations, and it would basically be a, you know, just a pure sort of cash flow analysis of, well, how much cash flow is going to come in over a certain amount of time. You know, if you created a promise out of that, would there be enough to pay it? And, you know, they were subject to a lot of volatility depending on the cash flows in their ideal. They were very prepayment law sensitive. And, you know, we got shown a bunch of them. We evaluated them, and it seemed like we were always, you know, had a worse rating assessment than the other rating agencies, and we basically rated none of them.
So what were they called? Forgive me the name of the
net interest margin. They're short. They're called NIMS for short.
Who ended up rating them? Do you know?
I don't know. I think S&P rated them. I don't know for sure.
Was there ever any discussion or criticism of you or your group or anyone working for you for not rating this?
No, not in my recollection.
We keep interrupting your efforts to walk us through the path. So why don't we get back on that path, and then we'll interrupt you again.
Well, that sounds awfully dull. All right, so where were I? I guess we were at the committee process.
That's right.
Where a lead analyst has prepared the memo, has made their recommendation, schedules a committee, including a, you know, somebody to chair the committee and other analysts. You know, there were times when the committee would include people from outside the RMBS group, like the banking team or somebody from credit policy. And in the committee, you know, the analyst would, you know, I guess first off, the chair would ask if anybody has a conflict. And, you know, we have a securities trading policy that's part of our, you know, policies to protect against conflicts. So an analyst who had, you know, any kind of a securities interest in the issuer that was, this, you know, behind the rating, you know, couldn't participate. You know, the chair would make an assessment as to whether the composition seemed appropriate to them. The chair would be moderating the conversation and make sure, you know, issues got raised and there was a fulsome discussion about the transaction and about the recommendation. So there would be this discussion among the people in the committee about the transaction. And then at the end of that, there would be a call for a vote. People could either vote on the, you know, these two numbers, the AAA number and the XBLX number that the lead analyst recommended, or they could propose an alternative recommendation if they thought, you know, other numbers were more appropriate.
Was the analyst's recommendation typically memorialized in some sort of document?
Oh, sure. It was in the committee memo.
It's called the rating memo?
Yeah, or the rating committee memo.
This was an input into the process, not an output from the process. That is, the committee rating memorandum was prepared by the analyst prior to the meeting of the committee. Do I understand that right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. But he also, the analyst would also modify the memo afterwards to memorialize what had happened, what the vote was, you know, what the final decision was of the committee.
But if you looked at the end memorandum, you would have the initial recommendation and the ultimate vote and rating.
Yes, you should.
And just in the terms of the process, an analyst has a deal that's to be rated. How does the analyst go about convening a rating committee? How's that process work? Does he pick up the phone and call a bunch of his friends down the hall? Does he send a Outlook calendar invite? Or does he know particular persons that he has to call, particular persons that he's not supposed to call? How did it work when you were a managing director? How did it work in terms of the process of convening a rating committee?
I mean, when I was there, it was generally through Outlook that the lead analyst would schedule a committee with people. I mean, the biggest issue was just finding the availability of a chair. because we had a number of senior people in the group. I mean, the managers could chair committees as well as certain other senior people in the group. And those people were often busy, booked up, whatever. We got to the point where we actually scheduled blocks of time where this person would have chairing duty, you know, from, you know, Monday mornings, and this person would have it, you know, so that people would know there'd be availability. So once they were able to find the chair, then they would invite other people, and they would invite people. I mean, the guidance was they were to invite people who would be appropriate for that committee, who would add value, who had expertise. I mean, you sometimes invite a junior person to as a learning experience, as a new person. But basically, the composition was supposed to be appropriate to the rating. And one of the responsibilities of the chair was if they got into the room and they said, you know, this is a hugely complicated transaction and all I see are junior people here, you know, reschedule the committee, you know, with some people who are appropriate for this committee.
Was there a minimum number of persons that were required to be on this committee?
It was a minimum of three. It was sort of more typically probably four or five. And three, I would say, were for more standardized deals. Like, it was a standard jumbo deal from a known issuer. Mm-hmm. Never less than three. And for anything else, it needed to be more than three.
And in the vote, tell me if this is correct, you went around the room, junior person first to the most senior person in terms of the vote.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
So that the senior person wouldn't be influencing the junior person.
That's correct. Okay.
Was there any forum shopping in terms of the managing director? Did you view that? In other words, if an analyst said, wow, you know, that David Teicher, he's really a tough managing director when he chairs the rating committee, you know, let's pick Warren instead. Was there any of that? Did you feel that there was any forum shopping in terms of how folks went about composing the ratings committee?
No, I did not think so. I didn't get that sense.
I don't want to jump off track, but did you feel that sense when you were in the CDO group from 01 to 05?
No, I did not.
Was there a particular director in the CDO group that had a nickname named Dr. No?
I don't remember that. Is that supposed to refer to Isaac? I mean, I'm just guessing just because he had a PhD and, you know. Mm-hmm. But I have no idea. I never heard that.
What about as an analyst when you were in the CDO group from 01 to 05? Were there certain managing directors that you knew that guy's going to be a whole lot tougher than the other person? And
I don't recall that being the case at all. I mean, for one thing, you know, we have, you know, methodologies. There's certain expectations about, you know, what analysis you're going to do, what you're going to bring. You know, what comparables you're going to look at. I mean, I don't think there would be that much variation. And as I said, you know, certainly in the RMBS group, you know, the availability of chairs was limited, and so I don't think that analysts would even be able to pick and choose, even if they wanted to. So I'm not aware of it.
Going back to the RMBS ratings committee, at any time while you were in the RMBS group, did anyone ever mention the amount of business or revenue from a particular issuer bank during the ratings committee meeting?
I do not remember that ever happening.
The initial version of the memorandum prepared by the analysts prior to the meeting of the ratings committee, forgive me, the title of that document is what now? What do you call that document? What's the term?
It's either the rating memo or the rating committee memo.
Okay. Let's call it the rating memo. I'm referring to that when I say rating memo.
Okay.
Shorter. Did it, in addition to providing the analyst recommendation on the expected loss number and the loss coverage for the AAA, did it also provide the same two numbers as produced by M3, the model, the quantitative model?
Yeah, that would be an input. I mean, that would be presented on the memo.
On the memo would be presented.
Because usually you'd have the M3 output, and then you'd have adjustments that have been made.
I see.
To those numbers, and then how you derive the final numbers.
I see. And all that was preserved in the post-rating committee meeting version of the rating memo.
Correct.
So we can go back to your story. So we're in the committee meeting. What's next?
So then after the discussion, there's a vote. As you point out, the most junior person votes first. Majority vote rules. So whether it's a vote for the recommended levels or an alternative proposal, one of those would carry the day. The lead analyst would then, take that information and use what would call the tranching model. And this was a simple Excel tool we had to come up with loss coverage levels for the ratings in between, AAA and the expected loss. And the expected loss, we pegged it, I think, like a B2 kind of a rating level. I'm not sure, in subsequent times, we may have moved off of that and gone down to B3 or CAA1. It has to do with kind of half the time, that tranche is going to lose money or something. I mean, I can't remember the exact logic about it, but we sometimes would refer to it as the B2 number.
Was that memorialized?
Yeah, I mean,
where you would set it. In other words, you said sometimes it was.
Well, no,
B2,
I'm saying subsequently as the modeling has evolved since this time in 2006, I think there's been more discussion around what that should be and whether it really translates into a rating level. I mean, the reality is I don't remember us rating tranches down to single B level anyway. We just sort of used it as a benchmark more than actually a rating level. But, I mean, these were the two benchmarks between AAA and, single B. And then the loss coverage for all the intermediate rating levels were then determined. So, how much loss coverage you need for a AA rating, how much loss coverage you need for a single A rating, how much loss coverage you need for a BAA rating.
Let me make sure I understand. So the rating memo that comes out of the rating committee meeting, that is, that they voted to agree on to endorse, has two numbers. One is an expected loss number, and that's the percent of the principal value of the collateral pool.
Correct.
That is expected to be lost, the expectation of the fraction of that principal will be lost, in a mathematical sense expectation, as well as a loss coverage with AAA.
Correct.
The loss coverage with AAA then determined the subordination or credit enhancement required below for the AAA tranche, and therefore determine the fraction of the liabilities of the RMBS that were rated AAA?
Well, that would depend on the structure.
Okay.
I mean, that could be true depending on how they structured it, but it wasn't necessarily true.
I see.
Basically all we're saying is, we think that the pool should be able to suffer whatever it is, 25% losses before the AAA tranche takes a loss. We want it to be able to absorb that much. How it absorbs it, we're neutral about. But just that somehow in the transaction, there's that loss protection available to that senior tranche.
And then the expected loss in the pool, you're saying that number was then used as the credit enhancement required for... You said initially with the B2 level.
Yeah, I mean, I think we just sort of we use that those two things interchangeably: the loss coverage for a B2 rating and expected loss.
And in the, I believe you call it the tranche.
I was just mentioning it just because just analytically, I know there's been some thinking about it since, whether that really makes sense or not, but that's what...
This is great. No, this is very, very helpful. So then you said it feeds into an Excel spreadsheet, which I think you refer to as a tranching model, which determined the credit enhancements required for the other rating levels between the B2 and the AAA, or whatever the expected loss
was
pegged to.
Right. I'm trying to get to the sense that these two were sort of endpoints.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And then we would use those endpoints to determine the intermediate.
And there was no other... So that tranching model to determine the intermediate levels of credit enhancement between the AAA and the B2, you didn't need any other data from the particular mortgage pool to do that? This was just done the same way in every deal through assumptions in the...
That's right. I mean, you know, we would sometimes adjust those for qualitative reasons or if we thought, you know, it didn't make sense for some reason. But basically, you know, the important things, the aspects we thought were really important were those two numbers. And then once we had those, we felt that the division of loss coverage was a mechanical process. And you'd want, you know, the more senior tranches to be thicker because our ratings go to expected loss. So we weren't just trying to measure a probability of default. We were also trying to measure how much of a loss, if they've suffered it. So the more senior tranches, we wanted to be bigger so that if they suffered a loss, it would be a smaller percentage of the overall security. And so the expected loss would still be lower.
Okay, so now we've run our tranching model. What happened? And that produces the output is credit enhancements for each level of ratings between B2 and AAA, let's mm-hmm. say. What happens next?
So after that, that feedback is provided to the banker. You know, when we say, here are our levels, that's how people would talk about it. Here are our credit enhancement levels.
How would that be provided? Was there a standard form document that was sent?
No, we just picked up the phone and called them.
Picked up the phone. Was it typically also sent in some sort of document?
No, typically not. I mean, frankly, we had a concern because they weren't ratings.
Yeah.
We didn't want to publish anything that could potentially be represented as a Moody's rating. So we never put it in writing.
But there was internally the ratings memorandum.
Absolutely.
But that didn't include all of the output of the tranching model, just these two numbers, basically.
I mean, the tranching results, I mean, I don't know if for sure they always got retained, but they should have gotten retained.
Sure. So then what happens after you communicate it to the bank or the issuer?
So the banker or the issuer would say, you know, I mean, they could just say thank you, go away, and then come back later after they've gotten levels from the other rating agencies or they've thought about it.
Yeah.
They could say, well, you know, S&P is much lower than this. You know, what are you guys thinking? And we'd say, this is what we're thinking. Or they could say, gee, you know, we'd really like to get a AAA rating on this. Let me think about, you know, changing the mortgage pool or restructuring or doing something. And get back to you. So, I mean, there were a variety of responses they could get, but that was basically the information they had, and they could then do with it what they wanted.
Was there ever an instance where they said, the banker, this would be the bankers, the bank you would communicate with, not the issuer directly, right? Or would you?
It's usually the banker, but in some cases, you know, like for, as I said, like the Wells Fargos of the world.
They were doing both.
And they were doing both. So, I mean, it was basically communicating to them.
Gotcha. So did the banker or the issuer ever say, hey, we think you got that wrong, and S&P down the street's offering something else, or Fitch is offering something else? Go rethink that. Did they ever say something like that?
Yeah, sure.
And was there ever an instance where a ratings committee might be reconvened to take into consideration any of those criticisms that an issuer or banker may have made for the structure or the rating?
I mean, if we thought, you know, there was new information, I mean, if the banker said, oh, you know, I forgot to give you, you know, XYZ that shows that each of these borrowers, you know, have reserves of, you know, 6 months each, and blah, 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 or whatever. I mean, if there was sort of additional information, we might go back and take that into consideration.
And how would you take it into consideration? Would you reconvene the rating committee?
Yeah.
And then would the ratings memorandum reflect that the committee was reconvened?
Yep, it absolutely should have. I mean, that was the practice. You know, you'd have the first... Usually what I think would be done is that the original rating committee would be at the back and then create a new rating, you know, committee memo with the current committee, and then as you flip through, you'd see the prior one. So, yeah, I mean, that should have been, you know, memorialized, that there would have been a prior committee, yeah.
And you said there should have been.
Well,
was it
what I'm saying
in all
is
instances?
I can't say it was in all instances, but that's why I'm saying, because, you know, we had practices for record retention and for providing these things, but I can't say that in every instance, you know, what people should have done, they did. I believe, you know, when I've looked at memos or when I've gone back, I've seen these things. Mm-hmm. But I just don't want you going back, you know, you subpoena a committee memo, it doesn't have this, and then you say, oh, that guy told me every time. You know, it's like, mm-hmm. I mean, I can't vouch for every single committee, you know. But that was our practice. That's what people should have been doing.
Well, let me ask you this. Did you ever hear of any instance, whether it be, you know, secondhand, thirdhand, water cooler talk, did you ever hear of any instances where a ratings memorandum was not updated to reflect that there had been two separate meetings, but it instead had been, you know, one meeting and not been updated?
No, I've never heard of that. I mean, it might have been two separate memos. It might have been they had a memo for the first committee, and then they just prepared a totally separate memo for the second committee. Mm-hmm. But they both should have been retained. I've never heard of a case where that first committee memo was not, you know, retained or wasn't available.
And did you ever hear of an instance where a rating committee was reconvened and a rating was changed without any significant change to the structure of the deal or the pool of mortgages?
Well, as I said, if there was new information about that existing pool, mm-hmm. Or if there was new information about the structure that we hadn't taken into consideration, I mean, the focus was on, you know, providing our best opinion, providing the best rating. If we did the committee with a certain amount of information and understanding and came up with a result, and then we were told later on, oh, but you guys missed this, 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 or, you know, there's this other information. You know, we do not want to sort of maintain a rating that at that point we think, oh, this may be wrong because we didn't take these other things into account. I mean, it was always focused on getting to the best answer we could and you know, having the most relevant information we could have.
And let me see if we can put this into maybe some specifics. Do you recall, are there any instances that come to mind where after telling an issuer, a bank, the ratings that you were about to issue, a bank or issuer said, yes, but you didn't take into consideration X or Y or Z, or did you consider that? And a committee was reconvened and a rating was changed because of not considering something. Where the deal didn't change, but you just hadn't considered something. Is there any? Can you give us some examples of where that occurred?
I can't remember a specific example, but I think that did happen. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was frequent or common, but my recollection is that there were cases where that happened, but I can't remember specific instances of it.
Great. Well, we've been going for a little while. Yeah, why don't we take a break if it's convenient for you?
Sure.
Take like a 5-minute bathroom break.
Thanks.
Great. It's 3:30. We'll go off record. All right. We're back on record after a break. It's 3:43, and we'll continue with Mr. Teicher talking about the ratings process.
So you had a phone call with the bank. you communicated the levels, that was the term used,
yep,
for a particular MDS.
Yes.
And what happens next?
And so the banker can either say, you know, we'll get back to you, can say, yeah, those you know, those levels will, you know, will work for the transaction, or they'll say, you know, they're too high. You know, it could be a variety of those kind of responses. But you know, if they just say, you know, they're too high, thank you very much, we're not going to ask you to rate this deal, then things would end right there. If they said, okay, that's you know, consistent with our expectations or what worked for us, we would then proceed to you know, to the next steps, and it would depend on the type of transaction, because then they would give us information about the structure of the transaction. So if it was a straightforward jumbo RMBS deal, typically the structure would be a standard kind of senior substructure, and the enhancement levels we gave them would correspond, as you we were talking about before, to the sizing of the tranches. If it were a subprime transaction, typically, and again, you know, we were indifferent as to where the credit support came from, where the loss protection came from, but typically they would have what was called an overcollateralization structure for subprime transactions that would involve a mixture of senior subordination, subordination of junior tranches to provide credit support for the more senior tranches, and to also use excess interest that was flowing through the transaction to cover losses directly and also to build over collateralization. So in that kind of a structure, the, you know, if the bonds on average paid 7% and the loans on average paid 10%, there'd be 3% extra interest. After fees, maybe it would be 2%. And so the 2% could be used to pay down principal on the most senior tranche. And therefore, you know, the principal balance of the tranches would go down as the pool balance would stay the same, and there you'd have extra collateral built in. We would model that extra interest to see how much loss protection we think that provided, because the amount of protection provided depended on a number of factors, you know, prepayment speeds, the amount of losses, the speed of the losses, what the OC limit, you know, what the there's usually a limit to how much overcollateralization was built up before that cash flow could then go to the residual class and go out of the deal. So we had a whole another model, which we called the spread model, that would model the amount of loss protection we viewed that cash flow provided. And there were different amounts depending on the rating level. So the assumptions we made for the support of the AAA were more conservative or more harsh or more stressed, depending what word you want to use, than the assumptions we make at the BAA level, in terms of, you know, what the prepayment speeds were. You know, the faster the prepayment speeds, less excess spread. So the faster the losses ramped up, the less loss coverage you'd have.
So the credit model, M3, this produced a whole distribution of losses, that is, a probability distribution over potential losses, which would also, from which you could calculate the expected loss of the pool. And that probability distribution was based on a bunch of simulation runs, mm-hmm, through various economic paths.
Right.
The spread model, does it take each of the underlying runs of the M3 model, or does its own simulation exercise? How do they relate?
They weren't linked at all. I know there's some development work going on about linking those kind of things, but in terms of what happened in 2006,
yeah,
or that time period, they were just totally separate. You know, because we had this model and this approach for coming up with loss coverage, okay, the sort of the basic idea of how much coverage do you need. And then there was a secondary question of how much loss coverage we believed came from this excess spread. And so it was just a completely separate model, no relationship to the M3, and would be applied after, you know, the committee process.
And was it a simulation-based model? That is
no. It was just a, it was a fairly, I mean, it was a cash flow model. It was not a simulation model. But it basically took as input, you know, what we call loss curves, which would be, you know, the amount of losses that would hit the pool at different points in time. And then it would look at prepayment. It would have prepayment curve, which is the level of prepayments that would occur over different points of time. And for each tranche, it would look at how much excess interest there was based on those assumptions, you know, that would be available to cover losses.
And the loss curve, how did you determine the loss curve to feed in for a particular transaction?
We used actually a variety of different loss curves.
Okay.
I think we had something like five different sort of scenarios that we would run. And the basic loss curve was based on historical performance, just on average what we've seen, you know, how we've seen losses come in.
So it was not at all a function of the characteristics of this particular pool?
No. It was related in the sense that we were trying to find, like if we were at, we would use a subprime pool, prior history with subprime to determine what the loss curve would be. So in that sense, it's kind of related to subprime loss performance as opposed to prime loss performance.
So you had,
but it wasn't a pool by pool specific curve. It was more of a, I mean, at the same time, if we thought there was something about this pool that would influence that, we would take that into consideration. We would adjust the loss curve. Like if they were seasoned loans, or if, you know, some of the loans were already delinquent or something at the inception,
yeah,
we might move the loss curve up to or back depending, you know, on the characteristics. But we had sort of the base set of curves, and some of them were more front-loaded and some of them were more back-loaded. And then in addition, you could run an even further curve, an additional curve to our standard curves. We have like five standard curves or something like that. If you thought it was justified, if you thought there was some reason why we needed to apply a different case for this particular pool.
So just to make sure I understand, so there were something like five standard curves, loss curves, for prime, let's say jumbo prime deals?
We didn't run this model for prime just because there wasn't excess spread. I don't remember there ever being this structure used for prime just because there wasn't enough excess spread, I think, to make it work.
I'm a little puzzled. I don't quite understand yet how this was sensible. So say you rated a particularly risky subprime pool. It just happened to be the case that the loan level information reflected out of M3 a much higher expected loss than most subprime deals.
Okay.
Would you use the same set of five loss curves?
I believe so, because, I mean, our overall levels would be higher. And I don't think we would say, okay, just because these loans are riskier, they're necessarily going to default faster. But again, I mean, some of the curves, I think, you know, were more front-loaded. And there was, analysts could always come in and say, you know, I think this pool is riskier. I think losses are going to happen more frequently. I think we should use a more front-loaded loss curve. I mean, but really, in this model, if you front-loaded the curve, it actually was more favorable to the transaction. It actually gave more benefit for the excess spread, because if losses come in early, it's a time when, you know, prepayments haven't, you know, eroded a lot of the pool. There's still a lot of excess spread, And so there's a lot of excess spread to cover those early losses. You're much better off if losses come in early in this kind of a model than if they come in late.
So it's bad for equity and it's good for debt in the deal.
Exactly. Exactly.
Got it. Okay, so what happened then?
So then this model would be run, and we had, you know, the analysts would run the model, and then we had a group of people who were called spread checkers, who were more senior people in the group, who would double check the results of that analyst. And then that information would be combined with the levels from the tranching tool to come up with final levels. And if you go back and you look at some, like if you got a prospectus for a subprime deal that Moody's rated, and you calculate how much subordination to AAA and say it was 25%, and then you dug up the committee memo from Moody's and it said loss coverage of 28%, and you said, but the deal was 25% and this is 28%. The difference is because we gave 3% credit for the excess spread. We decided that at the AAA, that excess spread and that structure provided 3% additional credit enhancement. So in addition to the subordination, you also had that. And that's how we got to the 28.
So what then?
So then we would communicate, basically, I mean, we would get the structure from the banker in terms of the tranche sizes they wanted to have, the interest rates on the bonds. We'd run this model, and we would tell them what ratings. At that point, we would say, okay, here are the ratings we would have on each of the tranches. And so that would be kind of the final result.
And is there a standard document that would be sent with a signature on it or something, or what was the...
No, again, it was communicated verbally, again, for the same reasons, but there would be memorialized in the committee memo or in related documents the results, the final results of that process.
Later? Well, so is there... What happens after this? Yeah, is there more to come, or is this the end of the story?
Well, this is pretty much... Well, this is the end of the analysis part of this, you know.
Yep.
I mean, we would communicate that. We'd say, okay, for the senior tranche, we're coming out to AAA. For the next tranche, we're coming out at AA1. For the next tranche, we're coming out at AA3. You know, we basically communicate those things, and then the banker would take those and put them in perspective.
And then they issued the debt.
Then they issued the debt, and in between this, we'd also be reviewing things, and before closing, we'd also get a final pool tape, because between, you know, the first pool they sent us and the end of the deal, some of the loans may have changed. I mean, I don't remember what that typical time period is, but you know, if it was a month or a few weeks, you know, some of the loans may have dropped out because they became delinquent or were dropped out for due diligence reasons, and maybe other loans were added. So we'd get a final tape that we would then run and compare against the original tape to make sure that there was no material change from a credit perspective.
Would you rerun M3 every time?
Yeah.
And how much, what was your definition of material? How did you determine whether it was material?
I think we had guidelines. You know, depending on the type of loans, and you know, where if it was within this band, it was okay, and if it was outside that band, you had to talk to a manager to see whether it needed to be recommitted or not.
And that band is about the
probably where the AAA or the expected loss come out.
I see. And do you have a sense for what the tolerance was?
I don't remember. I don't want to misspeak.
Sure.
I just have no recollection of what those were. Because typically, you know, the final pool is extremely close to the original pool, so it was never an issue. It was a rarer case that, you know, there was an issue with it, because the bankers didn't want to after all that work and selling the bonds and everything else, they didn't want to then at the end have to scramble and redo everything or have a closing that was going to get delayed. And, you know, with pools of thousands of loans, I mean, some subprime pools have like 5,000 loans in them or something.
Yeah.
You know, you can change 100 loans and it's not going to make a material difference to the overall pool.
Was the M3 model rerun every time at this stage, or was some variance in collateral allowed without rerunning the model? Was there another threshold that triggered an M3 run? See what I'm asking?
My recollection is we always ran M3 again at the end because it was easy. I mean, the tape would come in and you just clean it up if it needed to clean up and just run it through and see how it came out. It wasn't a lot of work.
So I'd like to spend a little time
for subprime, yeah,
getting into the weeds of your credit model for mortgage collateral. So prior to 2003, you used what you refer to as a benchmarking approach. Could you just describe that approach?
Okay. it really. It's a matter. The basic idea was that we were comparing the pool we had in front of us that we were being asked to evaluate against the prior pool for a transaction that we had already rated. So this isn't exactly the case, but you know, sort of imagine just for illustrative purposes, we had the quintessential subprime pool, you know, a standard LTV distribution, a standard FICO distribution, you know, all the parameters were just like, you know, it was like the National Bureau of Standards subprime pool.
Mm-hmm.
And we had assigned rating, you know, credit enhancement levels of, you know, 25, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, we had the set of enhancement levels we had assigned to that pool. And we felt really confident that those levels were correct.
On what basis? That is what we need. In the story you're telling, we need a genesis story, if you will.
Right, right. I'm sort of
a prime mover to begin this process.
Right, and so the history goes back.
This is prime in a religious sense, as opposed to a subprime sense, I suppose.
But we can go back to the Garden of Eden of securitization, yep, of mortgage securitization. You know, so the first mortgage deal I'm aware of, private label deal, was the Bank of America deal in 1977.
Okay.
I don't know if Moody's rated that deal, but I believe we started rating RMBS deals in the early 80s.
Yeah.
So, you know, we started to gain experience with the performance of loans and how to evaluate pools of loans, and we sort of built up a track record in a database of pools with different characteristics and levels we had given, and we could see, you know, did those deals get downgraded later on? Did they perform well? So over the years, we could get a sense of what we thought appropriate levels were, right?
Yep.
And this was before, mortgage models. And so given that history and that track record, you know, you had something in the past you could compare the current pool to. And, you know, I made up this case of this idealized pool just to explain kind of the basic idea of benchmarking.
Yep, sorry.
But, really, you could say, okay, last month we assigned ratings to this subprime pool, and the current pool from the same originator, you know, looks pretty much the same. It's a little bit, you know, the FICOs are a little bit worse, but the LTVs are a little bit better, and you kind of like, you know, it was much more qualitative. Like, is this about the same riskiness? Is it worse? Is it better? Is it much worse? And so you could kind of, you try to find something that's a fairly close comparison, and then use that as a benchmark, and then use the levels we'd given on that pool as a guide for the levels we should give on the current pool.
In that, to find the benchmark, was that done comparing one variable at a time, a distribution of one variable at a time? So, for example, you look at the LTV distribution of the pool you're rating and a precedent pool, let's call it. Similarly, then you go look at the distribution of FICO scores. Or did you also consider the joint distribution of several variables? So, for example, the existence of high FICO, low LTV, or perhaps more germanely, low FICO, high LTV loans. Does this make sense what I'm asking?
Yes. No. One of the shortfalls of this approach was that it was very hard to do that because you didn't really have a way of combining all the different elements of the pool and all the different permutations, all the different combinations of characteristics. You just had the summary characteristics, you know, the summary of the LTVs, the summary of the FICOs, so you were comparing, you know, kind of one next to the other. And one of the reasons why we were motivated to develop Moody's Morphic Metrics is because that model could take into account, you know, the risk layering or the joint, the combinations of factors.
So the benchmarking approach is unable to take into account the layering or combination of factors.
Right. I mean, in small respects, I think we were able to, I think some of the, what we call stratifications would say, you know, have a LTV distribution where the weighted average FICO score within that band would be reflected. So it would say, you know, the loans from 80 LTV to 90 LTV have a weighted average FICO of 670. And that would give you some idea of some of the, you know, but it wasn't, you know, it had that limitation.
Was this was the benchmarking approach an automated or software-driven process?
No, it was very manual. I mean, in the old days, we used to just type up the stratifications by hand from a printout from the factor-based model. And then I think eventually someone managed to automate that once we started using Moody's Mortgage Metrics. And, but it was very much of a manual process.
And for subprime loans, this benchmarking approach was used until when?
Yeah, pretty much through the end of 2006 when we started using Moody's Mortgage Metrics for subprime. I mean, one of the reasons why this approach worked so well for so long, and I say that just because, you know, our ratings, you know, performed really, really well, was because lenders, you know, a given lender would tend to produce very similar collateral from pool to pool to pool. They had similar underwriting standards. Their origination practices didn't vary a lot. So you wouldn't figure that they'd be playing around a lot with doing all this kind of risk layering and combining risk factors.
How much, though, did the underwriting practices get reviewed by Moody's in determining the ratings?
We definitely looked at underwriting guidelines from different lenders. We would periodically visit lenders, you know, talk to their underwriting staff, you know, talk to underwriters, you know, within their department. I mean, we would want to have a sense of, you know, what their practices were and how they did it. I mean, ultimately, the pool characteristics are, you know, what we were most focused on for a given pool, but we also wanted to understand in the background, you know, how they did their business.
Well, let's say Alpha produces one pool, Beta produces another pool. Alpha is one originator, Beta is a different originator. Mm-hmm. The characteristics of the pool are identical. Mm-hmm. Alpha has different underwriting standards to Beta. How would the ratings differ? Would they differ? Would there be haircuts given because Beta has lower underwriting standards generally or has worse compliance procedures than Beta?
you know, that would be a qualitative adjustment if we just thought, even if the characteristics were identical. And we had noticed that about pools in historical performance, that different pools with seemingly, you know, the same characteristics wound up performing differently over time.
But it would be a qualitative adjustment rather,
yes,
up front on the rating.
Yes.
Okay. Would you ever adjust up because you felt that a particular lender had very good underwriting standards or compliance?
Sure, it was a relative measure.
Okay. So in other words, if a lender beta you felt was a particularly good lender, the output from the model might be adjusted upward because you felt that the beta had better underwriting standards. Is that right?
Right. I mean, the enhancement levels would be adjusted downwards, but I understand your point.
I'm sorry.
You mean it would be viewed more favorably,
right, okay,
from a credit perspective. Yeah. Yeah.
And how would that determination be made? Who would make it?
It was made through a committee process. Sometimes we would have, I don't remember historically, I know at times we would have big committees where we would compare different originators. And we'd line them all up, and we'd line up their characteristics, and we'd line up their historical performance, we'd line up information we had about their origination practices, and we'd rank order them. We'd basically bucket them.
And would there be a memo from that committee where you would bucket them?
Yeah, generally, or at least the output of that process, where we would come up with what we would call originator factors, which were a factor we'd add to the M3 levels, for instance. That was sort of later on when we were using Moody's mortgage metrics to reflect that difference in our opinion on these different originators. But I think, you know, before that, we did make these distinctions, and it was probably mostly kind of implicitly baked in to the prior levels. Like when I was talking about the benchmarking, if you have a pool from City Mortgage and you're comparing it to a prior pool from City Mortgage, and you can see the levels for City Mortgage, that benefit or that hit is baked into those levels, so as you benchmark, you're implicitly carrying that assessment forward into the next pool.
And these originator factors, when they were generated, this was post-2003 when you were using the M3 model?
Correct.
Okay. And you said there would be a list or a memo of these originator factors?
I believe, I believe we have a memo or something where they're laid. We never made them public.
What were they called? What was that memo called?
I don't know.
If I said to Mr. Ross, I'd like those originator factors in that model, would you know how to go about finding them in Moody's?
Me personally, no, but I'm sure that
you would know how to describe them.
I'm sure our legal department probably knows where they are.
Someone knows where they are, right? Okay. We'll circle back offline with Mr. Ross to ask for those originator factors in the memo that describes those. These originator factors you said it was a committee decision that would come up with these originator factors, or was that something different?
I mean, it was a collective decision. I can't remember if it was a formal committee where, you know, all the formalities of a committee were met, or whether it was more of a group decision where everybody was in the room and we were all talking about it and we were all agreeing to these. But it was a collective decision. It wasn't like one person decided, you know, this is the originator factor.
And were you privy to some of those meetings where you would talk about the originator factors?
Yeah.
Okay. Who do you remember being at those meetings where you were talking about what the originator factors would be?
Well, I think the person, at least later on, I think maybe in 06 or 07, it was an analyst, Todd Swanson, who's in our San Francisco office, who had, I think, spearheaded the originator factors process.
And is Mr. Swanson still with Moody's?
I believe so. I mean, I don't know. I haven't heard from him or about him in a while, but I haven't heard that he's left.
Was Mr. Caniff part of that decision?
I don't know if he was there. Probably not, just because it was an RMBS-specific thing.
But Jay Siegel?
Jay Siegel might have been involved earlier on in some of those, Shore or Pramila. But
who was the highest or most senior person at Moody's who would have been involved in these meetings to go over the originator factor?
Probably just somebody at the team manager level, like Jay or myself or Warren. I mean, it was more of a detail that went into the analysis rather than something that would rise to the level of somebody above that. I wouldn't think somebody above would get involved in it, though. It wouldn't be, to my mind, it wouldn't be a negative, or to my mind, it wouldn't be anything important about somebody doing that. I just don't remember it. And I remember us doing this in the past, before 2000, where we, compare different originators and looked at their performance, looked at their origination practices, and ranked different originators by their credit performance and by our expectations for their future credit performance.
And as during your tenure as managing director over RMBS from March of 06 to September of 2008, how many times would you have gone and reviewed at Countrywide the origination practices that were taking place at Countrywide? How many times, roughly?
From when to when?
During his tenure from March of 06 to September of 08. How many times do you remember having a person from Moody's or persons from Moody's at Countrywide physically reviewing their underwriting procedures?
I don't recall. I actually never went to visit Countrywide myself. I know that.
Did anyone working for you ever go visit Countrywide?
I don't remember. I would think so, but I don't remember.
What originators do you remember, either yourself or someone working for you, going to visit?
I remember visiting Wells Fargo at least once, if not twice.
And what did you do while you were at Wells Fargo?
Talked with, the head of their secondary market securitization area. I remember from that meeting, Kathy Kelbaugh, who's an analyst in the RMBS group, I remember being there. She actually has an origination background. I don't remember specifically if we had a presentation from, the head of underwriting or the head of servicing or the head of quality control, but, those are the kind of people typically we would be talking to and thinking about. I remember a visit to what they call World Bank in San Antonio. They originated option arm loans and had done so for a long time. They went under a different name. I can't remember.
Golden West, I believe.
Yeah, and they were bought by Wachovia. I remember them talking to a lot of people there, like their underwriting people. And
when was that? Circa that you visited? I mean,
that would have been probably 2006 sometime, like maybe late 2006. I don't really remember, though.
You ever heard of the term exception or exception rate when it comes to mortgage underwriting?
No, I don't know what that refers to.
Exception with an E if I voiced in it clear. Did you ever look to see in terms of how many times the underwriter would depart or make an exception to their underwriting standards?
I see what you're saying. That was one of the things that we asked about, how many exceptions do they have. But at the end of the day, I think the you know, the characteristics of the pool were the characteristics of the pool. So if their guidelines were they weren't going to make loans to borrowers with FICO scores under 620 that had LTVs above 80, and the tape showed a loan with a FICO score of 615 and an LTV of 85, that would be captured in the characteristics. So it was less critical to the analysis per se, even though we did ask about it and were interested in it as a qualitative factor. It didn't have as much of an impact on the analysis just because we were looking at the actual characteristics of those loans rather than some average or some hypothetical pool.
And who developed the M3 model? I mean, who at Moody's came up with it? Who was involved in that?
It was Jay Siegel and David Jai.
Can you spell Mr. Jai's last name?
I think it's Z-H. I think it's Z-H-A-I.
Are those, is Mr. Siegel and Mr. Jai still with Moody's?
No. Jay Siegel left in April of 2006 when I arrived. I replaced Jay.
I see. You replaced him as managing director?
Yes.
In the RMBS?
Yes. David left a while ago. I remember he went to a bank to be like their credit risk manager or something.
Where did Jay Siegel go?
Jay Siegel retired. And he started a nonprofit involved in blood donations. And I think he continued to do some training work for Moody's. He may still do some training work for us on a consulting basis.
So I want to go back to this benchmarking model. So we chatted earlier briefly about barbelling, which, just to define it, is when an issuer puts in a mixture of very risky collateral by some measure along with much less risky collateral such that summary statistics of the pool appear not to be appear to be normal, but in fact the pool may have a higher than you would expect default performance or loss rate. Was the benchmarking approach subject to some form of that general notion of barbelling?
Well, I mean, now that you mention it, I mean, if you're looking at a pool with a FICO distribution, you know, two pools with the same FICO distribution and two pools with the same LTV distribution, you can see if there's barbelling by FICO or LTV independently. But if all the low FICOs are the high LTVs and all the high FICOs are the low LTVs, then, yeah, in theory, I could. I hadn't really thought about it, but I'll have to, you know, think about what we might have done to guard against that, or what other things, you know, what other steps we might have taken. But I see, you know, theoretically your point.
Was that possibility discussed ever at Moody's during your time there?
I mean, as I said, I mean, some of the, you know, sometimes we would include, I'm trying to think back because I'm a little stale on this stuff. You know, we would certainly include, as I said, you know, within a distribution, some summary statistics about other characteristics like FICO and LTV. We combine to sort of see that sort of thing. So I believe it was discussed because we tried to address it. And I know there were some other, in our old factor model, we had some tables prepared. Maybe it was like an LTV versus FICO chart where we try to capture that. I can't remember. But, you know, my thinking is that if I'm not remembering it, it probably didn't didn't come up because we had addressed it in some way, or it may have, I mean, I don't know. I'm just speculating now.
Let the record reflect that Mr. Ross is communicating with Mr. Teicher. Do you mind? We normally don't get a lot of lawyer witness communications during these interviews, and I just want to clarify that you're not giving him advice on how to answer questions, but you're talking to him about a particularly legal issue like the Attorney General settlement, or...
I don't think it's really required for me to tell you what I'm talking to my client about.
Well, I just want to make sure that we're not midstream getting a situation where we're talking about answering questions here.
I don't think there was a question on the table at the time I talked to him. I think he'd answered the last question, if I'm not mistaken.
Okay.
So why was the M3 model adopted in 2003?
I guess I don't know. I mean, as I said, I wasn't in the group at the time. You know, as I said before, we were always trying to improve our methodologies and our processes. And as a general matter, I think, you know, my understanding was a way of enhancing our methodology or approach or doing a better job of credit analysis. That was the motivation.
And why was the M3 model adopted for jumbo, prime, and Alt-A pools, but not for subprime pools?
I don't know exactly. I don't know exactly. I think there were some technical reasons why it might have had to do with the availability of data. You know, there weren't as many subprime loans at the time. But again, you know, you can talk to the people, you know, at Moody's who do the development work on models and have continued to, you know, develop M3 and refine it. I think they would be able to give you a much better answer.
Who would be the best people for us to talk to at Moody's about the M3 model?
I mean, Roger Stein is the person who comes to mind who's been involved in the... in the development of models generally, you know, hits that group.
What is Mr. Stein's title or role?
I think his title is Group Managing Director, and he's, I believe he's in charge of the group that, you know, verifies and validates models. I think he's part of credit policy.
Credit policy, I see.
Yeah.
Okay.
What about Jay Siegel? Is he knowledgeable about the details of the model?
I mean, he developed the model.
Is he knowledgeable about the details of it?
The current model or the model he developed?
Let's say the model he developed.
I mean, I don't know. I would assume so.
What about Michael Shea, XIE?
Michael was an analyst in RMBS and CDOs. I don't know if he's still at Moody's or not. And I'm not sure exactly. I don't remember exactly what his role was with respect to the Moody's Mortgage Metrics model. But I believe he had a quantitative background of some kind.
When you returned to the RMBS group, if I understand correctly, you use the benchmarking approach still for subprime pools, but M3 for jumbo, prime, and Alt-A pools. Is that right? Do I understand that correctly? So this would be March of 03 when you return? I'm sorry, March of 03. March of 06.
March of 06, I returned. So we were using, you know, M3 for prime. We were using the benchmarking approach for subprime.
And the benchmarking approach for subprime, if I understand this correctly, you relied on precedent deals, precedent subprime
issues that you rated that experienced some particular path of housing prices, was there any consideration of whether at that point, given the large run-up in housing prices nationally, the future housing price path may be quite different from the housing price path experienced by the precedents?
I mean, we strove to rate through cycles, right? We did not assume that housing prices would continue to rise. I would say that, if we're assuming, for a standard subprime pool where our enhancement to, our loss coverage assessment for AAA was 25%, that assumes that, 50% of the loans default and there's a 50% loss on average on each loan. I mean, that to me is an extraordinary assumption. In retrospect, what's happened strikes me as really extraordinary, but at the time that seemed like a very extraordinary event if that happened, even for an individual pool, much less the market as a whole. So, that implicitly takes into consideration the possibility of home prices declining and borrowers defaulting in a much higher frequency than they had before.
So you set it at 25%. You didn't set it at 30%.
Sometimes we did.
Okay.
Using 25 as kind of a round number, but it could be anywhere from 25 to 30 was typical in my recollection.
The M3 model, can you talk about the historical data that was, let's say, in 2006 when you returned? What was the historical data that was used in the M3 model to predict performance of loans?
Is there anything in the report about that? I don't remember exactly, but I have a vague recollection that we have published on that and indicated where we got our data set from.
Yes, it's from Control Pool Survey. So do you recall more specifically, for example, how far back the data set went?
No. I really wasn't involved in the development of the model and those kind of details. I'm not sure I ever knew it. I really don't remember.
So at any point from when you went back to the RMBS group in March 2006 until you left, was there ever any discussion within your group about the possibility that housing prices would indeed perform very differently going forward than they had in the past?
Maybe I should step back and discuss more kind of what we're, what the rating process is. We're really not trying to predict what's going to happen.
We're trying to
consider the range of possible outcomes, right? And so among the range of possible outcomes is that home prices could go up or home prices could go down.
So the question is, was there discussion in your group from March 2006 about the possibility that housing prices would perform much differently than in the past? It was a factual question.
Much differently in the past, I guess if you're talking about the past being like, the history of mortgage data that we had, or the history of housing data, back to the Great Depression or whatever, I don't believe that anybody thought that the housing market would perform dramatically different than what we had seen in prior recessions or in prior downturns.
Was there any discussion of whether housing prices would be quite different than in prior downturns?
I mean, in no, I don't remember. I don't remember there explicitly being discussions, you know, involving me. We were, you know, certainly watching the housing market, commenting on the housing market, listening to what economists and others were saying about the housing market. And as I said, you know, our approach was to consider a range of possible outcomes, and that, you know, at AAA we wanted the bonds to survive, you know, a wider range of outcomes than at, you know, lower rating level.
What kind of data were you getting on the housing market when you were the managing director of the RMBS group? What data were you getting? You said you were getting data, you were watching the housing market. What were you watching? What data were you getting?
I don't remember specifically. You know, there are trade publications, there's, you know, the regular media, there was information from, you know, our affiliate MoodysEconomy.com. In the M3 model, you know, there was baked in macroeconomic data about housing prices. You know, those are the sources that I can think of.
What trade publications would you have received as managing director of the RMBS group?
Asset-backed alert.
Mm-hmm. What else?
I don't remember routinely getting anything else. I mean, occasionally I would see there's a publication of the Mortgage Bankers Association.
Mm-hmm.
And I would get emails from the Mortgage Bankers Association, like little news update emails from them. And that's what I can think of.
Do you recall when you were managing director of the RMBS group reading any publication or hearing anywhere about any concerns about potential downturns in the housing market?
I mean, I don't remember exactly from where, but I remember there being, you know, concerns about housing prices being inflated and it being a bubble, but it seems to me, if I recall, that most commentators or all commentators were not suggesting, you know, anything more than, you know, a soft landing. That was a term I heard, or, you know, towards the end of 2006, early 2007, I believe, Mark Zandi, our economist at MoodysEconomy.com, was predicting like a single-digit decline, you know, a national decline in housing prices, something like that. The street firms were predicting. I mean, you know, we'd also get street publications, like from the research arms, like First Boston, I mean, Credit Suisse or Merrill Lynch, places like that.
When, if ever, when you were managing director, when did you become concerned about the housing market? When did you become concerned enough that you said, maybe we need to think about our ratings, maybe we need to think about our methodology, maybe we need to think about our process? Did you ever, during the process as managing director, have those thoughts?
I mean, I really thought that our rating approach to subprime was very robust. You know, I thought that the kinds of enhancement levels we were at very much took into account the risk that was there. I mean, particularly like at the AAA, as I said, I mean, the idea that 50% of the borrowers were default and you have an average of 50 just seemed so out on the tail that I did not really have a concern I think in early 2007, as we saw delinquencies really start to creep up on the 2006 vintage, you know, maybe in mid-2007, when it became clear that the performance was going to be worse than what it was in the prior recession in 2000 or 2001, that's kind of when it started to feel like this was materially different. But even at that point in time, I was not thinking that the AAAs were going to suffer losses. I didn't think that the losses would get to the point where the AAAs wouldn't still pay off.
Were you only concerned about the AAAs?
No. I mean, certainly at that point in time when the performance was deteriorating, we were worried about, and I was worried about, the lower rated tranches. And how much higher our enhancement levels, you know, possibly needed to be going forward in light of that performance. I'm just saying that even at that point in time, I just did not imagine that things were going to get as bad as they got.
What tranche of an RMBS structure went into MES CDOs?
The MES CDOs, I think, were the BAA tranches.
And did you have any conversations with anyone in the CDO group about the BAA tranches at any point in 2006 or 2007?
You know, at that time, there were a lot of conversations, I believe, going on with surveillance, and there were a lot of conversations going around generally in the group. I don't remember myself specifically having conversations with the CDO group about the BAA tranches.
At any time?
Not at that time period, no.
When do you recall downgrades, Moody's doing downgrades on RMBS, significant downgrades?
I mean, those would have been things that I heard about.
Would you have been involved in the downgrade process?
No, because that would have been handled by separate surveillance teams.
So you wouldn't have been consulted on the downgrades of any RMBS structures that you have rated?
I don't recall that happening. I recall hearing about the downgrades. I might have heard about them, you know, while they were being considered. I don't know. I don't remember it.
So you just don't remember being consulted on the downgrades or being part of those conversations about the downgrades on RMBS?
I'm trying to remember. I mean, I know that we first downgraded subprime in November of 06. We started the downgrade, and then we did bigger downgrades in the middle of 07. I don't remember really being consulted now specifically about the downgrades. I mean, it was a separate group. They were operating independently. You know, I remember going to presentations, I think, where they were, you know, discussed. You know, we had teleconferences and whatnot to discuss them. I don't really remember being involved in the process.
Did the downgrades from November 2006 affect or influence your ratings post-November 2006? And if so, how?
Well, there was definitely a, you know, an awareness that the 2006 transactions were not performing well, were not performing, you know, as we would have expected, that they were performing worse than they had in prior years. Not as bad at that point as they had performed in 2000, 2001, but, you know, still not good performance. And so, I mean, that impacted the way we were rating new deals.
How did it impact the way you were rating new deals?
That we were making, you know, we were assuming higher levels of losses going forward.
And how would you have assumed higher level losses going forward? Would it have affected some of these benchmarks that we've been talking about? Was it a qualitative adjustment? Was it a quantitative adjustment? I'm just trying to understand. Downgrades in November 2006. December 2006, you're rating a deal. How did those downgrades in November 2006 get factored into ratings done in December 2006, for example?
I don't think that the downgrades in November 2006 necessarily impacted the ratings in December.
Mm-hmm. So when would they have affected the ratings? Would it have been January 2007? Would the January 2007 ratings have been affected by the downgrades in November 2006?
I just don't remember the exact chronology of events. I know that sort of generally during that time period, we were increasing our loss expectations for subprime pools. I don't recall exactly when or by how much, or I don't think it would have been a model change as much as a qualitative change outside the model, that we would have looked at the performance and said, you know, our expectations of losses are now higher given what we're seeing happening.
Mm-hmm. What was the process by which you were increasing the loss expectations for subprime pool? Was it a committee meeting where you would get together and
it would be
do this?
For each transaction that we were rating had a committee, and each of those committees, there would be consideration of, you know, what our loss coverage level should be. I mean, that was, as I described, that was sort of the two characteristics that mm-hmm. we were deciding in committee.
So was it a deal-by-deal determination in terms of how much to increase the loss expectations based on these earlier downgrades? Or would it have been something, you know, across the board where you would have a committee that would have met and said, you know, we just downgraded in November quite a bit of RMBS, and as a result, we're going to, across the board, increase our loss expectations?
And I'm trying to remember, because there was just a lot going on at that point in time. I do remember there being meetings with the surveillance team where there would be discussions about their projections of losses going forward on existing deals.
Who were at these meetings?
Well, I remember that Nicholas Vail would have probably been heading those. I think he was head of surveillance at that time.
And you would have attended?
There were some meetings that I remember attending. I don't know. I don't recall that there were committees on rating actions, but I mean, I did attend some committees later on the monitoring side. But that was, I think, after this point, and it was not related to subprime per se. But with respect to this time period and, you know, subprime transactions, I remember there being, they may have been meetings around reports we were publishing, publishing on our increasing loss expectations, for existing transactions.
And these papers that you've described about publishing on increasing loss expectations, were these papers published by the managing directors of the RMBS group? Was it a different group? Who was involved in this process? I'm just trying to understand the loss expectations and coming up with increasing loss expectations due to prior downgrades. How did that process work? Who was involved? Who developed these papers? Was it you? Was it your group?
The ones I'm thinking about would have been done by the surveillance team. It would have been done with Nicholas in terms of our increasing loss expectations on existing deals.
These are not new deals, though.
No.
Okay.
We in my group, starting in March of 2007, started to publish a series of reports called subprime update reports, where it started with I think it started in March of 2007 with a report called Challenging Times, where we discussed the performance we had to date, what our expectations were, what our thoughts were about where the market was going. And my recollection was at that time it was too early to tell exactly where the market was going or where losses were going to go. And we weren't changing our expectations at that point in time because the performance seemed consistent with what we'd seen in the most recent recession. And if the losses actually turned out to be the same as those, which were worse than average, but still within the expectations we had for existing deals and would not in and of itself, our expectation have resulted in downgrades.
Who wrote Challenging Times?
It was, I think it was authored by DeBosch, but it was a collective effort. I mean,
did you have a role in writing it?
Absolutely, yeah.
Who else do you recall had a role in writing Challenging Times?
Pretty much everyone. Joe Snaylor, Claire Robinson, Michael Caniff, Mark Duryens, Warren Kornfeld, Nicholas Vale. I mean, it was...
Brian Clarkson?
He definitely reviewed it and commented on it. I mean, he was not involved in the, writing of it on the detail level, but after, we had written it, he reviewed it and made comments on it.
How did he make his comments? Written, oral, how?
I have no recollection. I have no recollection.
She said he definitely commented on it. How do you know he definitely commented on it?
It's just my recollection that he commented on it, whether he sent an email with his comments or whether he marked up a hard copy because he read it on the, train going home. I just don't remember. I remember him saying he thought it was a good report, it was well written, and he had some comments.
What generally were his comments? What do you recall his comments?
I don't actually recall any of his comments, other than he said it was well written. And I thought, given the number of people who worked on it, it was a good thing he thought it was well written.
who was the scribe? Who was actually the person responsible for?
I mean, DeBosch was the main author. I mean, he was the scribe, but I had a fairly big hand in editing. Joe Snaylor as well. And then, as I said, there was sort of a large group of people who contributed to what went into it.
How'd you do your edits? By redline, on Microsoft Word, by hand?
I mean, comments, I don't know. I mean, whether it was on a hard copy, whether it was by email, whether it was, marking up through Word. I assume it was prepared in Word because that was the word processing program we all used.
At what point, now you described March of 2007 and challenging times as not making any significant changes. When did you start viewing ratings going forward as a different ballgame?
You know, my recollection is, and there were a number of different things going on all at once. My recollection is that we started in early 07. And part of the reason I say that is because I think it was around that time, and I might have my dates a little bit wrong, is that we started to notice not just the early payment defaults after the deal closed, but the fact that the initial pools that we were looking at included defaults. And we developed a methodology for addressing that and published on it. And I know that was increasing our loss expectation on some pools. I don't recall if our base loss expectations were increasing at that time just because, as I said, at that point in time, it looked like the increasing delinquencies could be tracking, you know, what we had seen in the prior recession, which would have been within the expectations of our current ratings. I don't remember exactly. I mean, I would have to go back and look and see, you know, what our committees and it looks like. I mean, at the time we were asking for, you know, I mean, we had a series of publications at the time in addition to the subprime update reports. I remember there being one where we were asking for additional data fields to, you know, help make our analysis more granular.
When was that?
I think it was sometime in mid-2007.
What additional fields do you recall asking for?
I'm trying to remember. Because after that point in time, we continued to be on a process of asking for, you know, additional fields and working with the ASF on their project restart and, you know, talking about just kind of this in industry sort of, you know, that would be helpful to have additional fields. So I can't remember exactly which fields came later, which fields came later. I just remember there being
Were they related to the contractual structure, for example, for option arms, were additional fields requested on those features? Does that ring a bell?
It might have.
What about on the documentation status of the loan? Does that ring a bell?
I would think. I thought we were pretty much capturing all the different nuances on documentation already. I remember at some point, and I don't remember if it was then or later on, we thought getting data fields with more information about, say, other properties the borrower owned, or, you know, more credit bureau information than just FICO score, like number of trade lines or something.
Record reflect that Mr. Ross is conferring with the witness. Do you have something to add, Mr. Ross? Oh, sorry, Mr.
No, I don't have.
Sorry.
Brilliant.
Well, Brilliant. Mr. Teicher, do you have something to add?
Well, I was just going to say, I mean, again, I think I would need to go back and sort of look to see and just remember kind of where we were, you know, increasing levels. And I know we put out a lot of publications, and we would have explained in those publications what we were doing. And I'm just not remembering it very well right now.
There's a point that you, in this, similar to the line of questions that I think my colleague was getting at, but a tad bit different, and that is you receive a pool of loans and they already have defaults in them. Could the could the bank or the issuer pull out loans and substitute for new loans during the rating process? Or at what point in time would a pool be frozen in time for a rating?
At closing. So any time before closing, in theory, you know, loans could be changed.
Mm-hmm. And the fact of the changing of the loans, did that factor into the rating in any way?
I don't recall that it was a material factor. It was much more, you know, what were the loans, you know, in the final pool.
Mm-hmm. So would it have concerned you if there were defaulting loans in the initial pool and they were pulled out and replaced with new loans? Would that have, the fact of pulling loans out and putting new loans in, would that have been something to cause you concern in terms of the rates?
Well, I think if we thought that, you know, there was an increase in early payment defaults at that time, early payment defaults being borrowers who default, you know, on one of their, you know, first few payments, which is, you know, always considered an unusual thing because when a loan's first made, you don't expect the borrower to default right out of the box. You know, I know there were a lot of discussions because we were seeing increases in early payment defaults at that point in time. But the mere fact that someone pulled out defaulted loans and substituted performing loans, you know, it would affect our, you know, assessment going forward if we felt that the new loans going in were going to experience higher early payment defaults, for instance, than they had in the past.
Would you, was that your, you referenced before, you had a methodology for handling pools in which there were loans that were in default at closing. What was the methodology?
Before that?
No, going forward. You had a new methodology.
Yeah.
What was the methodology? How would you account for it?
I don't remember the details of that. We just would assume, you know, a higher proportion, you know, that those loans would, you know, would ultimately result in losses at a higher rate than, you know, on average than the other loans in the pool.
Did such loans represent a violation of representations and warranties by the sponsor or the originator?
I mean, I do recall that, you know, some of the you know, sort of reading in the press that some of the issues involved in the repurchase of loans by, you know, New Century and other lenders had to do with early payment defaults. That would be due to, you know, some kind of a breach of rep and warranty around that. Or it could be that the early payment default signals another problem with the loan.
And so what was the methodology in place for handling these already defaulted loans prior to this change?
We didn't see them. I mean, we just started seeing them for the first time, you know, in late 06, as I recall. So when we started to see them, we started to address it, but we hadn't seen them before.
In July 2007, there you mentioned this earlier, in the middle of 2007, there was a large group of downgrades by all the rating agencies of RMBS. Did that trigger any change in methodology for rating new RMBS?
You know, it's strange, but I'm not remembering, again, the exact chronology of events there. I know that our loss expectations increased in 2007.
Yep.
I know that was happening. Exactly when that happened or how it related to, I just can't remember exactly.
So when was the M3 model adopted for subprime RMBS?
At the end of 2006.
Who made that decision to adopt the M3 model for subprime RMBS?
I don't remember exactly.
Were you involved in that decision?
I was not that involved with the Moody's Borg-Demetric model or its development. I mean, as I said, there were three managers of the RMBS group, as well as a group managing director, and I can't recall how it was decided, when it was decided. And I wasn't that involved in the development of the model or the development of it for subprime. So,
you mentioned Warren Kornfeld was, of the three managing directors in the group, the one, I believe you said he was more involved with the M3 than you and Mark Duryanz.
Yep.
Do you suppose that he's likely the one who was involved in the decision then to adopt M3 for rating subprime RMBS?
I'd have to ask him.
More generally, who had authority in Moody's, authority and or responsibility within Moody's for making decisions on methodology?
I mean, it was the, at that time, it was, primarily the managers of the team. So that would have included, myself, Warren, and Mark. But it wasn't so formalized a process. I mean, it's become much more formalized since then. But it could have been. I mean, I don't really know exactly how it was done. I certainly didn't raise an objection to using M3 for subprime. I didn't have any reason to believe that it shouldn't be adopted. And I know it had been in the works for a while, and with an expectation that it was going to, the decision was made to build the model and start using it for subprime.
Why was it adopted in 2006 or subprime?
So I think that was when it was ready.
What made it ready?
Whatever development work there was being done on it was completed. And, as far as the technical details of what that means, I'm not the best person to answer that, since I wasn't as close to it. But, when you build a model, I assume there are a lot of things that you need to put in, test, and, there's a development process.
Was the M3 model ever compared to the benchmarking model which it replaced?
I mean, I think that the model was, calibrated to be consistent with the levels we have been giving.
And what parameters of the model were adjusted to calibrate it?
I don't know.
Did you ever compare your models to S&P's or Fitch's?
Never.
Did you ever look at S&P or Fitch's models or try to reverse engineer them?
No.
Do you know if anyone did?
I'm not aware of anybody at Moody's did.
Do you know if anyone at Moody's compared ratings between Moody's models or Moody's proposed models and models used by S&P or Fitch?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
So do you know if anyone at Moody's ever took a Moody's model or a proposed model and said, here's how this model or proposed model shapes up compared to S&P or Fitch?
No. We had done a lot of default studies on the ratings themselves. Right, to see how ratings have performed over time, which was in intended to sort of give us information and to capture, you know, what our ratings performance is, but I don't believe anybody ever specifically looked at our model and compared it to those of anyone else.
Hey, Brad, just a question on timing. I know you would... We're getting close to the 5:30.
We'll wrap it up soon.
So let me go back in time, actually. So you began in Moody's in the late 1990s?
Right, in 1996.
At that point, it was still a subsidiary of Dun & Bradstreet.
That's right.
And then the IPO was in 2000.
I think that's right, yeah.
2000. And Brian Clarkson took over the structured products group around that time as well.
When I got to Moody's, Brian was the group managing director responsible for RMBS and maybe another group. I can't remember which other group it was.
Sorry, when was that?
In 1996.
In 96.
I don't recall when he got promotions or what role he was in at the time. It was the time the company went public.
Were you aware, let's say from 1996 to 2000, of people in your group being terminated?
I can remember a couple of people.
Who are those?
One that I recall hearing about. I mean, again, I don't know for a fact, but it was...
Who terminated him? Who made the decision?
I assume one of the managers, which would have been... At that time, I don't know if it was...
What is your understanding of why he was terminated?
I mean, I don't really know exactly why he was terminated, but I think...
What did you hear?
That he wasn't that strong analytically.
Did you terminate anyone?
Did I?
Ever.
Yes.
Who did you terminate? Let's start with when you were managing director of the RMBS group. Did you terminate anyone then?
Moody's had layoffs in late 2007. And I believe there were five people from the RMBS group who got laid off. Actually, in that particular instance, I was not the one who terminated the company. I think that decision was made at a higher level. There were a lot of people being laid off at once as part of the layoff. And there were discussions around people's performance. And I was part of those discussions around performance. But the actual decision as to who would get terminated was not my decision per se. I mean, I didn't pull the trigger.
Prior to that time period, did you have any?
Prior to that time period, no one in RMBS and no one in compliance. While I was in compliance, a couple of people left the firm voluntarily. And when I was heading the CDO surveillance team, there was one person in the team that I did terminate.
Why was that?
He just wasn't doing his job. I mean, he was coming in late. He just wasn't working. He didn't, seem to understand the role. And it was a range of behavior.
A few more wrap up here. Did you ever have any direct conversations with Chris Ricciardi?
Hmm. you know, when I was in the CDO group, I would speak to him at conferences sometimes. I'd run into him and we'd say hello. I don't remember, I'm trying to remember if I ever spoke to him in a deal-related context. I mean, there were times when the CDO group and the, you know, at Moody's and the CDO group at Merrill Lynch would, you know, meet and he would be there and that sort of thing. It wasn't frequent.
You don't recall any conversations about a specific deal, though?
I do not, no.
What was your interactions as managing director of the RMBS group with Brian Brooks? Would you meet with him on a frequent basis, a regular basis? What were your interactions?
I didn't interact with them a lot while I was the, you know, when I was the manager of the RMBS group. I mean, he was already, you know, I don't know, two or three levels, yeah, I don't know, at least two or three levels above me. Mm-hmm. We would talk on that hoc basis. Sometimes it was about things like, I guess, like the Challenging Times report. I don't remember if I talked to him about that specifically or whether he just commented on that. It was occasional.
Were you ever given reports of the market share of Moody's in RMBS? Or other market segments while you were managing director in the RMBS group?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I was.
How frequently?
I don't remember if it was quarterly or monthly, but it was periodic.
Why did it matter what Moody's market share was?
In In my view, you know, it was not a problem to lose market share for credit-related reasons. You know, if we weren't rating deals because our assessment of the credit was more negative than other rating agencies, that was a legitimate reason to not rate deals and to lose market share. But if you're losing market share because you're not returning phone calls or, you know, other reasons not credit related, you know, that seems like something that, you know, is worth knowing about.
But who was told about the market share? Was it just the managing directors of the RMBS group? Or were other employees, analysts, told about the market share?
I'm not aware that the analysts were told about it.
How were you told or informed about market share? By email, by memo, by meetings, all of the above?
I remember meeting with Michael Caniff, mm-hmm. and he would have a market share, you know, a report that someone would have put together about what deals had been issued, what deals we rated, what deals we didn't rate. And, you know, there would just be a discussion about, you know, why we weren't rating certain deals. You know, what deals we rated, what deals we didn't.
Why do you believe that market share was important to Mr. Kane?
I mean, I can't speak for him. You know, in my view,
did Mr. Caniff ever say to you why he believed market share was important?
Well, I think I don't recall specifically him saying that, but I think there's he never said we should compromise credit standards to rate a deal. Or, we lost this deal because our enhancement levels were higher than somebody else. And, can't you do something to bring that down? He never said anything like that to me. And that was never suggested. I think it was really more to see... let me go back to a time to put this maybe in a little bit of context. I mean, there was a time when issuers just were angry with us because we were not very transparent or not transparent enough for them. This was like back in the 1990s. And they wouldn't even talk to us. They wouldn't show us their pool. They wouldn't talk to us, not because of ratings or credit or anything else. They just were angry with us and they didn't want to work with us. I mean, as a manager, I would think I'd want to know that, because that's something that can be potentially remedied without sacrificing credit quality, right? Without sacrificing the quality of the ratings. You just basically pick up the phone and you say, look, I'm sorry we've had, bad communication in the past, or there's been problems,
Did Mr. Caniff ever express any frustration to you in losing a particular deal to a competitor?
No, never.
You said you'd have meetings, though, with him, and you would talk about how certain deals might not have been done, that other competitors had done deals and not Moody's.
Right.
Why would he talk about that? Why was he bringing this up? What did he say?
Well,
was this a good job, I'm glad we steered clear from that deal, or how did we not rate that deal?
If you finish this.
We're almost.
I think it was more to see if there were reasons, other than for credit reasons that we were not... rating certain deals. For instance, the net interest margin deals that I mentioned before were always on that list, time and time again. And it was just, it was understood that, we just had a different view of the world and we weren't rating those deals.
Did Mr. Caniff ever say we should have rated that deal for anything?
I don't remember saying that, no.
And this list, you said there's always something on a list. Was this a list that he would produce? Did it have a name?
It was a list that would be produced, I think, by an administrator or something. I mean, it was just basically somebody who'd look in the market and say, okay, what deals were issued this time period? Which deals did we rate? Which deals did we not rate?
Before you have another question, just at your request, we've got people standing by for the poll that you had asked for 5:30.
I know. Can we, if they could continue to stand by, if not...
Have an estimate?
Let's go another... Let's table them for 15 minutes and we'll wrap up before then. Yep.
Okay,
good. Who was the administrator that came up with that list?
There was a guy named Edmund Lee. I think his name was Edmund Lee. Who, I don't really remember what his... title or function was, but I think he produced these lists.
How often was the list produced?
Again, I don't recall whether it was monthly or quarterly or biannually. I don't really have a recollection about it.
Did Mr. Edmund Lee, did he work for Mr. Caniff? Who did he work for?
I don't think so. I actually not 100% sure who he worked for.
Who got these lists? Who received the list?
I mean, I know about the list that Michael got because I saw it.
Did you get the list?
I don't know if he sent me the list or... I mean, I remember us meeting together and him having this list. And I don't remember if he sent it to me beforehand or whether we just looked it over together, you know, when we met. And I remember us looking it over together when we met. I just don't remember if it got to me before then.
Was this a meeting with just you and Mr. Canep, or were there other managing directors present for these meetings?
I just remember it being me and Michael.
Okay. And would he meet with the other managing directors like this, one-on-one? Do you know?
I believe Warren told me he would meet with him, too, on this.
Okay. And who else was present, other than Mr. Canep and yourself, would meet with him?
Just the two of us.
And did the list have a name? Is there a name at the top of the list, the lost deals list? Does that ring a bell?
I don't remember. I don't remember. I remember it being a spreadsheet. I do not remember what.
Do you remember there being some legend at the top?
No. I mean, I tend to not look at the legends anyway. Mm-hmm.
Did Mr. Canep indicate at any time that Mr. Clarkson had seen the list?
I don't remember Michael saying that. No.
You said that. How often do you remember having these meetings? How many meetings did you have like this? Ballpark. 1, 2, 5, 10, 15?
I mean, my recollection, it was sort of like
four meetings,
but it's just a vague recollection. It wasn't like real frequent. It wasn't all the time. I mean, it just feels that way. Like maybe we met four times over there.
Four times over your tenure as managing director of the R&S Group?
I think so, but I don't want to remember.
Would he ever ask you to go back and look at a particular deal that wasn't rated and come back to him with any information?
I don't really remember specifically. I don't really remember specifically. I mean,
sitting here today, what do you remember Mr. Canep telling you at any of these meetings about any of the deals?
You know, I remember him showing me the list and just saying he wanted to walk through it. And I don't really remember it being very memorable. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think that's the issue. I mean, my understanding of these meetings was that, you know, we didn't want to not be participating in the market, having our rating issued, having our opinion out in the market. For reasons, you know, other than, you know, we just couldn't get to the ratings that somebody wanted to have on there.
Remember anything else being said?
No, I really don't. I mean, I just remember these meetings being denied.
What was your typical market share during this period in RMBS?
I don't remember exactly. It was you know, 80s or 90s somewhere, as I recall. Just general matter. I mean, you know, it's more than 100 because there were often two ratings on
Right. So market share is probably not the technically correct.
So what I mean is the fraction of deals that move.
I mean, the other thing to think about, I think, with market share is, you know, do you count it based on outstanding balance? Do you count it based on number of deals? Do you count it based on securities ratings? Because there was a period of time where I believe we were not rating a lot of the subordinate tranches on subprime deals because our methodology had gotten more, you know, we had been increasing our loss expectation and had a more negative view than S&P, and it didn't affect, say, the AAA tranche because we felt comfortable with that, but it might have affected the subordinate tranches. So the subordinate tranches we didn't rate. So if you look at market coverage based on deal count, it would be higher than if you did it based on number of securities.
What did your colleague Warren tell you about his meetings with Mr. Caniff to discuss the list?
He didn't really tell me anything other than he'd had these meetings. And I don't even remember what context.
Did he describe the meetings as benign?
I don't remember.
In your meetings with Mr. Caniff, did you also talk revenue?
No. I think there was revenue information that was circulated. I remember that being in an email.
Email from whom?
I don't recall.
To whom?
I think it was to all the managers, you know, with a spreadsheet showing revenue for different lines of business. I mean, you know, the RMBS group, ABS group, ABCP group, you know, like a structured finance kind of. Maybe not all the structured finance, but within the area, maybe it's like a Claire level.
What level? I'm sorry?
Claire Robinson, a senior managing director level.
It would be sent to her level or sent from her level? I'm sorry.
It would cover the groups reporting up to her. So it wouldn't include, say, derivatives or CMBS or something else that was reporting to another senior managing director.
Mr. Teicher, we appreciate your time. Appreciate you coming down to Washington to meet with us. Is there anything that we didn't ask you today that you expected us to ask you?
How was my train ride?
Aside from that.
No, I mean, I actually, you know, I wasn't sure what to expect. And so I'm happy to, you know, provide.
Was there a particular topic or discussion or email that you expected to be shown today or talked about?
No.
Anything else that you think we ought to know that we didn't ask about that you think is important for us to understand the ratings or the rating methodologies?
Well, I think we covered a lot. I know if you go through the rest of this presentation, you know, it gets to the surveillance part, which we didn't talk about. You know, after the deal closes, it's handed off to a separate surveillance team and the kind of information we get as part of our surveillance process.
Mm-hmm. But you weren't involved in the surveillance of RMBS, right?
That's right.
Who was involved in the surveillance of RMBS?
I recall Nicholas being head of that group initially.
And you'll be talking to them shortly.
Yeah.
There's one thing we didn't talk about is your role in the surveillance of the CEO section. If we revisit you by phone or one time when we're up in New York just to talk about that issue, would you mind speaking to us about the surveillance of CDOs?
No, not at all.
I want to make sure you get on your train back to New York tonight and we get on a call to talk about fun IT issues. But would you mind if we revisited you with Mr. Ross concerning the surveillance of the CEOs?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't mind at all.
That'd be great. Okay. Thank you.
Best of luck.
Thanks.
Thanks. Appreciate it.
And again, if you keep our conversation confidential and don't discuss it with anyone outside of your council, we would appreciate it. And we'll go off record now. The time is 5:45.